NRA-TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to Cam and Company right here on NRA-TV. Fueled, as always, by our friends at Hornady Ammunition. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Glad to be with you today. We've got a fantastic program for you. Let me run it down for you real quick. Ed Morris, he's going to join us from Hot Air, talking about some of the big stories of the week. Also, David Van Buren from Tax Solutions. If you're a longtime viewer slash listener to Cam and Company, you may remember Dee Dee Van Buren from Tax Solutions. They're here in the Central Virginia area, closer to Richmond. And David actually lives in Chesterfield, where they're talking about putting armed mentors in the elementary schools. These would be retired law enforcement who would be armed. Who would be there as that first line of defense if an active shooter came to the door, but would also be there throughout the school day to serve as mentors to the elementary school children. This has met with at least a little bit of opposition there in Chesterfield, Virginia. Has also met with some support as well, so we'll talk with David Van Buren about that later on in the hour. Next hour, Chuck Michelle is going to join us from Michelle and Associates out in California. We're going to talk about the decision by the California State Supreme Court yesterday to uphold California's micro-stamping law, even though the court acknowledged that it's impossible to comply with the law. The court says just because it's impossible to comply with the law doesn't mean that we can toss it out. So you have a situation right now in California where the state has told fire manufacturers, handgun manufacturers, if you're selling a semi-automatic handgun in the state, you've got to have this micro-stamping in every one of your firearms. So every new gun that comes into the state, it has to have that micro-stamping stuff so that on two separate places on the shell casing, you've got stamped when the gun fires this unique code, this unique set of identifiers. Now, that doesn't exist. And so the result is there have been no new models of semi-automatic handguns that have been introduced for sale in California since this law went into effect back in 2010. Now, that's bad enough. In California, in order for a handgun to be sold, it has to be on the roster of handguns deemed not unsafe for sale, I think is the name of it. And not only has it's not that just that the list has been static since the micro-stamping law went into effect, the list has grown smaller. Because every time an existing model of handgun, if there's some sort of design change, a screw gets taken out, that, according to California's Department of Justice, constitutes a brand new model. And it, since it doesn't have micro-stamping, you can't sell it in California anymore. This is a ban by any other name. It's a long-term ban. Right now, it's a restriction on the number of firearms that you can own. You're the type of firearms that you can own. But you can't purchase the most commonly sold handguns in America right now, even though they're commonly owned for lawful purposes, because the state of California says no. And the California State Supreme Court says, well, you know, look, there's nothing here in the law that says we have to toss out a law just because it's impossible to comply with. So what are the next steps? Again, at issue here was not a Second Amendment issue. The issue was over the enforceability of a law that is impossible to comply with. So you could, I guess, go back at it from a Second Amendment viewpoint. You could take this case, move it up to a federal court. This case brought by the NSSF, along with several firearm retailers in the state of California. But we'll talk about it with Chuck Michelle coming up next hour. Also next hour, Carol Markowitz of the New York Post with a great column. Do we have to erase the name of Laura Ingalls Wilder to fix history? And who will be next? This was several days ago. And the news cycle has sort of surged past this story. But yes, Laura Ingalls Wilder, the Little House on the Prairie author, her name was on an award, a library award. It's been taken off because I guess we can't read Laura Ingalls Wilder anymore because at the time she was writing, that's back in the, and she's writing about growing up in the 19th century. Apparently she talked about Native Americans in a way that is inappropriate, and so therefore we have to burn the books yet. We at least have to put them aside. In hour three, Stephen Miller from FoxNews.com joins us. He's got a piece of the New York Post With Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's rise, Democrats, he says, now own their loony far-left flank. Not only do they own it, I think that flank is largely in charge right now. Did you see the flip by Kirsten Gillibrand, Cameron, on ICE?
Yes.
You know, the swap with the Second Amendment, that came years ago. As soon as she became senator,
right,
her support for the Second Amendment just disappeared. You know, she found the light, scales dropped from her eyes. But yes, when it comes to immigration, she also, too, used to have some things to say about illegal immigration. Didn't really like it. But now it's time to abolish ICE.
Mm-hmm. And we also saw, this wasn't a flip, but we also saw Mayor de Blasio talking about it. So this is becoming, for the far left flank of the Democratic Party, this is becoming a thing. And as you said about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and as you were talking about that, I just saw a tweet from her. I guess she was on Stephen Colbert and CBS News talking about what she said. They love this woman. It is an amazing thing to watch. This little known beyond her district, even in her district a week ago, is like the savior of the Democrat Party. And we're obviously seeing who the media is rooting for. It's not the Pelosi's and the Schumer's of the world. It's the de Blasio's and the Ocasio-Cortez's of the world. And it is blatant. They slobber over this woman. It's incredible to watch.
Well, listen, just from a generational aspect, I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is 28 years old. Nancy Pelosi is 148, something like that, right? I mean, you know, come on. If you're looking for that new young audience, if you want the millennials to tune in, of course you're going to want to swap out Nancy Pelosi with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's a real question. If and I don't think this is going to happen, but if the Democrats were to take back the House, because I do think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is going to win her seat. This is a, you know, deep, deep blue district. So I think she's going to Congress. If the Democrats took back the House, Cameron, there would be, I think, at this point, there would actually be a move to make her Speaker.
Oh, wow. Whew. I don't know.
And it wouldn't come from in Congress. Don't get me wrong. Here.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh.
No, okay.
But, again, that far-left flank.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. She's the next queen of the left flank of the Democratic Party. This woman can do no wrong. I saw another tweet. She like called out President Trump. I mean, it's the new I think she's the new Stormy Daniels. Everything she says will become an article now.
Well, given these socialist leanings, maybe Stormy Chavez. Maybe that can be We'll talk a little bit about what's going on in Venezuela, by the way, this afternoon. Tony Katz from WIBC will join us on the program as well this afternoon. Plus, we have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy. Definitely want to talk about what happened in Annapolis, Maryland yesterday, as well as the media reaction to this. Not necessarily the on-air media reaction, but a lot of columnists. The attempt to try to make this about gun control. I'll just give you a brief look at what it is that I'm talking about here. I ran across this. This is in the South Florida Sun Sentinel, a paper, by the way, which has done fantastic reporting on the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. They, along with the Miami Herald, have continued following that story in the months afterwards as the national media has sort of, you know, faded away and not really paying attention. Those local papers, I've talked about it on Cam & Company previously, they've done a great job in continuing to cover that. Andy Reid at the South Florida Sun Sentinel has a column today, headline, Newsroom Shooting, Another Example of Failure to Face Gun Violence. And here's what he writes. I'm just going to read the whole thing to you. He says, it's natural for anyone who works in a newsroom to worry about the what ifs after five people are gunned down in the Capital Gazette newspaper in Maryland. Journalists make a lot of people mad in a country with a lot of guns. But as unsettling as that thought may be, journalists know that there are much more dangerous places to be when it comes to the risk of gun violence. Places such as a school and a church and a nightclub and an outdoor country music concert and an airport baggage pickup area and a college campus and a restaurant and a center for people with disabilities and a movie theater and even a baseball game. A game played by members of Congress, a game involving powerful people who, even after getting shot at, still refuse to pass tougher gun control laws or significantly reduce funding for mental health programs. Powerful people who, even after their inaction, get reelected by people full of so many thoughts and prayers. Yes, he writes, we have a lot of dangerous places in this country, if only we were willing to do something about it. And then rather than describe the something, that we should do, Andy Reid just ends his column right there. That's it. I kept scrolling. I thought that there was more to it. Nope. That was it. Again, a lot of calls to do something, but not a lot of calls about what exactly to do other than something. But not just any something. It's got to be a gun control-ish something. But we'll talk about that later on in the program. We do have some breaking news, actually, as we begin our show this afternoon out of Oregon. So this just came out maybe 15, 20 minutes ago. There were two ballot initiatives that gun control activists were trying to get before voters in Oregon this November, IP43 and IP44. Both of those, the ballot language was reviewed by the Oregon State Supreme Court. IP44, which dealt with storage requirements for firearms, the Oregon State Supreme Court said, yep, that's fine. That language is good to go. You can start collecting signatures. And for whatever reason, the organizers said, well, we don't have enough time. We'll do it in a couple of years. It was really bizarre. The organizers of IP43, meanwhile, said, okay, we're waiting on the court to say what it is we have to do. And we feel confident that, you know, we're going to be able to get these 88,000 signatures. Well, the court came out earlier this week and said, all right, there are some problems with the ballot language. The definition of, quote unquote, assault weapon is misleading. The definition of large capacity magazine is misleading. The summary of what happens if you vote yes or if you vote no on this measure, misleading. So the language needs to be tweaked. They sent it back to the Oregon Attorney General's office to tweak the language and then get it certified. Meanwhile, there's a deadline of July the 6th for these anti-gun groups to gather 88,000 and some odd signatures in order to put this before the voters. The organizers of this campaign, many of the members of clergy, said they were going to be using houses of worship in order to gather these signatures. So, again, they expressed confidence they'll be able to do so. This would be the last weekend where they would be able to actually get signatures at these services. Well, the Attorney General's office still hasn't produced the language there that they can use to gather signatures. So supporters of IP43, an effort to ban certain types of semi-automatic firearms and magazines holding more than 10 rounds, will be withdrawn. This will not be on the ballot this year, according to the Polk County Itemizer Observer. Rabbi Michael Kahana making the announcement. Reverend W.J. Mark Knudsen says supporters may propose another petition or multiple petitions in 2020. They say they're not done yet. But they're not going to do it this year. Knudsen said, quote, every appeal process was used against us. A lot of money was used against us. We have no apologies for our process. We heard the voices of the young and we moved right in. I don't think anybody has any apologies for the process. The process is what the process is. But the Oregon State Supreme Court told these organizers, hey, the ballot language that you submitted, the ballot language that people are going to be voting on is misleading. So whoever wrote that language perhaps should be apologizing, because that's one of the reasons why this isn't going to be on the ballot in November. If you're a gun control supporter, you should be a little disappointed at the fact that, you know, once again, here you have gun control groups that apparently can't get it right. Remember in Nevada with the quote-unquote universal background check referendum, which ultimately passed by about a 1% margin of victory, but it passed, only it couldn't go into effect because of the way the gun control advocates themselves wrote the language. The state of Nevada was not going to be conducting these additional background checks. This was going to be done by the FBI, but nobody asked the FBI if they would be willing to do these extra background checks. And as it turns out, the answer was no. And so now you've got an unenforceable referendum, again, because of the flawed language offered up by the supporters of the referendum. Meanwhile, Oregon Secretary of State Dennis Richardson advocated for changes that would allow supporters of a petition to gather signatures after a battle title has been approved for a petition, but before any legal challenges have been resolved. He said, whether or not I agree with a particular cause, I strongly believe Oregonians should have the right to petition their government without the deck stacked against them. I urge the legislature to adopt the grassroots petition protections that I have consistently advocated. Well, you know, again, that sounds nice on paper. But then the problem becomes, if you're asking people to sign on to a ballot measure that's actually not going to be the ballot measure in question, are you gathering those signatures under false pretenses? Should you not actually be able to look at what it is that you're signing on to? Otherwise, you could put anything out there. Look, we got our 88,000 signatures. Supreme Court could say, well, this is really way off. You got to tweak this, this, change that, 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 and that. Well, maybe you don't have 88,000 supporters of what that language looks like after the Supreme Court's through with it, or after the Attorney General's office goes through and revises it. Might look like a completely different measure. So, again, it's one of those solutions, soundbite solutions offered by politicians, but the devil is always in the details there. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, Mr. Ed Morrissey joins us from Hot Air. We are just getting started here on this Friday edition of Cam and Company, so stick around. We'll be right back with more right after this.
We are talking with the authors of the brand-new book, The Great Revolt, Selena Zito, Brad Todd. And Brad, I'll start with you. Give us the subtitle, because I got The Great Revolt, but every good book needs a really long subtitle as well. So what's The Great Revolt, colon?
Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics.
There you go. And I imagine that there are a lot of members of that populist coalition here today in Dallas.
I'd say that maybe 100% of this building is inside that coalition. We even have a chapter in the book. It's a look inside the Trump coalition and not just how it changed the election in 2016, but try to spark the conversation what else is going to change in American commerce, American society. One of our chapters in the book is what we call Girl Gun Power. We examine sort of seven types of the Trump voter, and Girl Gun Power is a group of women who voted only on the Second Amendment or made that the dominant issue in their vote, which that's a thing a lot of the mainstream press completely ignored, wouldn't understand it if they did know about it. So hopefully this book will bring that to life.
Yeah, in particular, suburban, college-educated women. I think that they totally missed their understanding of the empowerment that it gives you as a woman. It's the ultimate feminist thing to do, to be able to protect yourself.
Well, they do miss it, because what we hear is that any woman who owns a gun is doing so not because of empowerment, but because of fear. They're being, you know, pressured by their husbands, or they're being, lectured by someone like Dana Lash. But they're never able to actually make that conclusion on their own that I want to be a gun owner. It's so amazing. It's become a common trope now of this is how you got Trump. Well, this is how you get President Donald Trump, and this is how you get the Great Revolt, when you refuse to take your fellow Americans seriously for exercising, you know, their right of self-defense. If you're going to shame somebody for making that decision, you're not taking them seriously.
Well, one of the most important things, and Brad, you can elaborate on this because you're way smarter than me, but one of the most important things I think about the book is that we're in the middle of this movement and nobody's hearing what it's telling us, that there are so many variables into why these voters came together. You know, Trump was not the cause of this. He was the result of it. And it hasn't stopped. It's continued. And I would argue, maybe I'm wrong, that it's getting stronger as opposed to sort of losing its high winds.
Well, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? And the what's happened on the cultural left, and I think with sort of brand decision makers, they all live in L.A. or Seattle or San Francisco or New York. That's very far removed from sort of this populist conservative coalition. And so I think you're seeing that they're making brand decisions that reflect the bubble they're in, and not their customer base. And I think you're going to see more and more customers say, and we're not going to put up with that.
I hope so. So let's talk about who makes up this coalition, because, again, if you listen to those folks in L.A. or D.C. or New York, flyover country, you know, Hillary Clinton made this comment about, well, the progressive parts of the country, the forward-thinking parts of the country, they voted for me. But those backwards places, those little burgs and hollows around the country, where the gap-toothed rednecks live, now is the places that voted for Trump. Who makes up this populist coalition?
Well, they're optimists, first off. That's one thing I think that our book brings out that you don't see in coverage of the Trump coalition much. You know, Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again, is an optimistic, forward-looking slogan. Her slogan, I think, was Better Together, which is a statement of the present tense, not the future. And our we did a survey of Trump voters in the five states in the Midwest. It's all in the book. All these details are in the book. And they believe, they're very optimistic about their own personal career choices, their own personal financial situation. Even if they're worried to death about their communities, country's financial health and economic health. I think that's something the press also missed. You know, if you read most news accounts of Trump voters, you'd think that they were, you know, angry and strung out on heroin and, you know, unemployed. And, you know, it's a, that's the way that the New York Times or the Washington Post wants you to see the typical Trump voter as. We found that they were, and we were on the ground in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and in Macomb County, Michigan, and Keokuk, Iowa, all in sort of these places in the middle of the country, very optimistic people. They just want their country to be fixed.
Thank you again for being a part of Cam and Company here on this beautiful Friday afternoon, heading into July. Coming up about an hour from now, Carol Markowitz of the New York Post joins us on the program. But right now, our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air is with us on the program. Ed, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, sir?
Excellent. I'm really glad I decided not to wear my purple polo today. That was the other choice. Purple or black, purple or black. I decided to go with black because we would have looked like the California Raisins. And I don't know. Maybe I just was we were just mind melding this morning, but I'm really glad I didn't go that route. Also, you know, I've been thinking that we have you on every week here talking about the news of the week. But, boy, we might have to impose on your schedule because it seems like by the time you get to Friday, there's just way too much news for one segment.
Hey, you know, I'm happy to come on whenever you need me, Cam. I mean, it's always a blast being on with you. But yeah, it's the news cycles. I think Ala Pundit was saying something that it had been 20 news cycles since Peter Strzok's testimony, right? Later than the same day. And I said, it's been 20 news cycles since 5 p.m. I mean, that's the way these things are going these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back a couple of news cycles. To Justice Anthony Kennedy resigning, which was widely anticipated. And then when it didn't happen from the bench, most everybody kind of, okay, I guess that's not going to be a big story today. And then a couple of hours later, oh, no, it's going to be a huge story today. So the fallout here, we still don't know who President Trump is going to pick, but already we're hearing from the left, whoever it is, they have to be stopped. Somehow, we have to stop this vote from taking place. I've heard everything from, Democrats just shouldn't show up, so they don't have a quorum. Now you've got, attempts to try to peel away a couple of Republicans, right? If we can get Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins to peel away, then if all the Democrats stand firm, won't be able to get these votes. And again, we don't even know who the nominee is yet, Ed.
Right. Yeah, this is what you call politicking at its worst, which is all strategy, no substance here. They're just simply planning on obstructionism for obstructionism's sake. And I don't think that that's a particularly good look. The truth is that there's really nothing Democrats can do because they defanged themselves with Harry Reid's nuclear option, which Mitch McConnell, very predictably followed up on when it came to Neil Gorsuch's confirmation. That was about a year and a quarter ago. And here's the thing. Had Chuck Schumer just said, we're going to let the vote go through on Neil Gorsuch because Neil Gorsuch is A, qualified candidate, and B, he's replacing Scalia, which means that it really doesn't affect the balance of the court, you'd still have the filibuster rule in place for the Supreme Court confirmation. And I don't think Mitch McConnell gets to 50 to undo that at this point in time, not for Anthony Kennedy's seat and not with the number of people who have been alienated by Donald Trump, Jeff Flake for one, Bob Corker for another. I don't think Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski would go along with it to replace Anthony Kennedy. And we'd be left with a 60-vote cloture threshold on a seat that actually matters a lot more than Neil Gorsuch and the open Scalia seat. So this is the type of shooting oneself in the foot that the Democrats have been pretty good at over the last several years. And now they're going to start attacking red state Democrats in the middle of a campaign over whether or not they're going to choose the right side on a Supreme Court nomination that hasn't yet been made. I mean, it's practically playing into the Republicans' playbook here. And Chuck Schumer is apparently not a good enough strategist to have seen this coming.
Well, okay, so was it that Chuck Schumer's not a good enough strategist, or was it that Chuck Schumer and Democrats in leadership generally have been trying to corral that far left flank and you know, look, you can stay with us, right? You don't have to vote us out of office, trying to keep that energy up. I mean, you've also got a piece at Hot Air today about Kirsten Gillibrand,
and now adopting the position of let's abolish ICE. Right. And again, you talk about strategy over substance. And she doesn't really, she says, let's replace it with something that'll be better. But that's about as specific as she's willing to go. This is also another sea change for Kirsten Gillibrand, not the first 180-degree flip that she's had in her career as a senator, also on gun control. But, you know, again, it seems to me like the political energy right now among Democrats is on that far left side. And so you've got those politicians in Congress trying to, you know, hold their coalition together because their coalition, Ed, is fracturing. You know, people like to talk a lot about the Civil War on the right. Well, the left has its own issues, too, clearly.
Well, this is what you put your finger on one of them, which was that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I believe is her name, was a surprise winner in a New York House primary in just last week, I believe it was, or maybe it was Tuesday. Who knows? It was
last Tuesday.
Several hundred news cycles ago.
Yes,
it could have been.
Right.
Yeah, it could have been Tuesday of this week. It's still several hundred news cycles ago, and Gillibrand was getting blasted because she never reached out to Ocasio-Cortez, and never because she endorsed the Joe Crowley, who was the incumbent there, as 11-term congressman member of the House Democratic leadership team, and so now she's kind of. And that was the context of her remarks with Chris Cuomo last night in saying we need to get rid of ICE is because that's what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said. And she's trying to backpedal now to burnish her progressive cred because Ocasio-Cortez has openly criticized Gillibrand for not contacting her prior to issuing the endorsement for Crowley. And so it's this one upsmanship. It's trying to outdo the radicalism of the progressive left. And it's taking Democrats in a very strange direction for a party that wants to win in places that Republicans have won for the last several cycles. I mean, they're getting more radical rather than more moderate. And they're issuing these calls. I mean, it's a nonsense call to get rid of ICE, but continue to enforce the law that we've got. I mean, the issue isn't ICE. The issue is the law that ICE has to enforce. And if Gillibrand doesn't like that, doesn't like the law that they're enforcing, well, she's in luck. She's actually in a place where she could propose new laws and work with the majority to help get them passed. Instead, she's calling to replace ICE with another agency that's going to end up doing the exact same thing that ICE is doing right now. It's silly.
But it'll do it in a kinder, gentler, fuzzier way, I suppose. Right.
Well, that's a political direction, and that was based on the election that we just had, which was fought in large part on immigration policy. I mean, that was a big part of this campaign, and so if that's what you're arguing about, then it's still not ICE that's the issue. You just need to win an election, and Democrats are about to give us, I think, chapter and verse on how best to lose one.
I suspect you're right. I will always offer up the don't get cocky. But you're right. I mean, they're certainly making a lot of – we were just listening in the last break to Selena Zito and Brad Todd talk about their book, The Great Revolt. And, you know, again, if you're wanting to make inroads in those places – here's the thing, Ed. It's not that the Democrats would be making inroads into places that they've never held before. We're talking about a lot of counties that voted for Barack Obama. In 2008, that voted for Barack Obama in 2012 and then swung 20, 30, 40 points the other way to Donald Trump in 2016. You were just talking about if Democrats want to take back those counties that they had 4 years ago, or 6 years ago, you've got to actually talk to the people who live there. And instead, the message to the people in those counties is these days, you're a Nazi. You're a Nazi. You know that. Now, it doesn't matter if you voted for Donald Trump or Barack Obama twice. If you voted for Donald Trump, you're a Nazi guard.
Yes. I mean, it's almost as though Karl Rove is writing the strategy for the Democratic Party. And I don't mean that to denigrate my friend Karl Rove, who's brilliant. I mean it to say that basically it's almost like he's a mole inside the DNC and he's directing all of this. It's crazy to go this far out into attacking the voters when you're trying to convince people outside your power base that you're worthy of trust. And this whole issue with with the Supreme Court nomination is a great example of this. You had Cory Booker, Gillibrand, I think Kamala Harris was out there in front of the Supreme Court yesterday demanding to know whether or not these red state Democrats who are up for reelection in very difficult states are on the side of Democratic leadership or if they're on the side of the president making his own pick. These, you know, I don't know what the voters of New Jersey and New York and Elizabeth Warren was out there, Massachusetts and California think about this, but I'm pretty sure that the people of West Virginia, Indiana, and what was the other one? North Dakota probably trust Donald Trump to make that selection a lot more than they trust Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to make it. And the idea that you're going to demand party fealty on this issue from people who are at such high risk of losing their seats is, I think, the epitome of a party that is choosing an extremist purity, almost a puritanical approach to politics, rather than an accommodation or a compromise or at least a rational approach to politics. It is self-defeating to an enormous extent.
Yeah, usually the purges take place after you've consolidated power, not before.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Totalitarian leadership 101.
Yeah, Republicans have done that too. I mean, I don't mean to say that Republicans have never done this, and we've had our share of purity campaigns in the GOP. And in fact, we were kind of in the middle of one in the 2016 cycle. It just didn't work. And so this is it's an impulse that everybody has because everybody wants their position to prevail, and I get that. But the reality is that Democrats are defending 26 seats in the fall, 9 or 10 of which Donald Trump won, and Republicans are only defending one seat in the Senate where Hillary Clinton won. That's Nevada with Dave Heller. And so, I mean, the idea that you're going to enforce a purity campaign on Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, and Bill Nelson in Florida, and some of the other red state Democrats who are already showing signs of being in deep trouble, is self-defeating. It's just on the face of it, it's self-defeating.
Talking again with Mr. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. All right, last story, Ed. You've got a write-up that is well worth a read at Hot Air right now on the shooting in Annapolis, Maryland yesterday at the newspapers, the Capitol Gazette newspaper building, where 5 journalists were killed. And, you know, I'm going to talk later, Ed, about the blame game. I'm not going to ask you to talk about that at all. But, you know, one of the reasons why I want people to read your piece is because you actually get to, I think, the heart of the matter is that, once again, this was an individual who was known to law enforcement, was actually known to the victims, right? There was quote one of these former employees, Mr. Marquard, who said that he wasn't surprised to hear the accused killer identified as the alleged gunman, saying that he had started harassing the paper and its staff shortly after they wrote an article in 2011 about this guy stalking a woman. The harassment escalated for years, Marquard said, with online threats. He said, "I was seriously concerned he would threaten us with physical violence. I even told my wife we have to be concerned. This guy could really hurt us." He said he called the Anne Arundel County Police about the shooter in 2013, but nothing came of it. He consulted the paper's lawyers about filing a restraining order, but decided against it. He said, "I remember telling our attorneys, quote, this is a guy who is going to come in and shoot us." There's also a guy who was originally charged with felony stalking, pled down to harassment. And apparently the judge granted a probation before the judgment was finalized in this case. It wasn't even on his criminal record. I mean, there are things to talk about with this case, even, you know, on a more broad topic than just this specific case. But I don't think gun control fits easily into that. I don't think the incivility debate in our country fits into that. But I do think we can talk about, you know, we can talk about things like this, like what happens when you've got this harassment, when this stalking is occurring, and yet, you know, you go to law enforcement or you go to your attorneys, and it's kind of like, well, you know, if you escalate things, it might just get worse, right? Maybe it's best to just leave this alone.
Yeah.
And I have to say too, Ed, I think part of the problem was this guy, you know, again, they saw what happened. He was charged with a felony, bled down to a misdemeanor, got probation, nothing happened. So I think that there's almost there's a realistic expectation of, well, even if we talk to the police, even if we, you know, file the restraint order, if we do all these things, what good's it going to do?
Yeah, you know, I want to be very careful about this, too, because I don't necessarily think that what the paper did was unreasonable. I don't know if the court – I don't know enough about the court case to know if what the judge did was unreasonable. I think that when you're faced with the situation, there is a very strong impulse not to make things worse by escalating the situation. And I can't fault them for thinking that that might be the better – that that might be the better path, especially mm-hmm. at that time. But I think it's becoming clear that unless you start enforcing the gateway – violations and enforcing the laws on these gateway violations and setting up a record, a criminal record for people who do this, you are basically encouraging them to keep escalating on their side. And I think that the newspaper staff is a brave workforce. They put out a newspaper even in the middle of this. They were reporting this in the middle of this. I have a complete admiration for the people who were there. None of them deserve this. I don't think what they the choices that they made were unreasonable, but I think in retrospect we can learn that when you're faced with somebody who's an irrational stalker, you have to apply the law hard, fast, and often in order to box them in so that they can't do things like buy a shotgun last year. They would have been stopped from doing that.
And that's a multi, and here's the thing. I listen, I don't disagree with a thing that you said there, but that is a multi-pronged process that involves the victim, and it involves law enforcement, and it involves the prosecutor, right? It's the it's the police, it's the prosecutor, and the victim. All of those individuals have to agree to get tough on this, because otherwise, I mean, if it's just the victim, well, they can report it to police, but you know, after that, what happens? Or if it's just the victim and the police, but the prosecutor says, "Nah, we're going to plea bargain this down again. We don't really have the time. Too much of a, you know, have you seen our caseload lately?" You're right. There are, and there are, again, as you say, there are all kinds of truly common sense, practical, pragmatic reasons why this happens. That's not the question. The question is, what can we actually do to fix it? Well, I mean, and it's not about pointing fingers. It's not about, you know, playing the blame game. But it is about acknowledging this is a real problem. You're not going to solve it with soundbite solutions. You're not going to solve it by the political infighting. But it's an issue. And we need to talk, we need to at least start talking about it so we can hopefully get some good ideas. Ed, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Enjoy your weekend. I'll coordinate wardrobe with you for next week. And we won't be talking to you before Independence Day. So happy Independence Day to you as well, sir.
Happy Independence Day to you too, sir. And thanks to the NRA for promoting independence and freedom too.
Absolutely. Ed Morrissey joins from Hot Air on Twitter at Ed Morrissey. David Van Buren is going to join us. Seriously, Cameron, I was like this close to wearing a purple polo today. That would have been funny, but it would have been awful. California Raisins right there.
good reference. I fear that our younger listeners have no clue what that means.
Who the what?
Google it, kids.
I know. Yeah, right. Why is Cam talking about raisins? I don't understand. It's okay. That reminds me, for Father's Day, my kids, Cameron, bought me a T-shirt that I had requested, and none of them knew what the design was. It's a spindle for a 45.
Oh, they didn't know what that was?
None of them had a clue.
God, that literally is painful. I have a visceral reaction to that. God, I hate hearing stuff like that. Oh,
I know. Every one of my kids asked me that day, what is this anyway?
Well, kids, let me tell you, when I was a little wee lad, we had these things called LPs.
Oh, like you buy at Urban Outfitters?
Yeah, like that, only there were whole stores devoted to them.
I know, it was not a good day. All right, when we come back, actually, it was a really good day. David Van Buren's going to join us from Tax Solutions in Chesterfield, Virginia. We're going to talk about a proposal there in the Richmond suburbs to put armed mentors, retired law enforcement, in every elementary school there in the school district. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up next. So I'm very pleased to actually get a chance to talk in person with Kyle Kashuv. Kyle, how are you, man?
It's good, man. It's good.
What made you decide that you wanted to speak out, even though you knew that what you were saying was going to be going against the narrative? And it's not, by the way, like you came out and said, hey, you know what, I think everybody needs to own every gun possible. What your message was, let's talk about things that actually work, things that we can all agree on. And I think that kind of got lost a little bit.
I mean, a lot of people like to straight up go and push policy that they don't really know about. What I've done is I've taken the time and I've looked at every single policy that I'm pushing out, and I've talked to senators and I've talked to people pushing the policy and creating the policy, and I said, look, there's an issue here, we have to fix that, but in total, I want to push policies that work. I don't want to push policy that ideologically sound good but don't do anything. As the president said yesterday, people like to push things that make them feel good, not actually impact the community and the nation positively. And I've been very careful in choosing what legislation I'm pushing and what I'm fighting for. It has to have more pros. The pros at the end of the day always have to outweigh the cons.
You've had an opportunity to speak, as you say, to a lot of politicians, including the president.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many senators you're up to now. And the interesting thing is, you're not only talking to people who you may agree with, you're talking to people who you probably disagree with, too. You're not afraid to have those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's idiotic to kick out and not even talk to half of America. I mean, whether or not you disagree or agree with their policy, it's still they represent millions of people, and they make decisions. And if I can even on a sliver of change their opinion on a subject, why not do that? Why not think about the other side while trying to explain to my side? Like, I talked to a senator, and I explained to them the position of the Second Amendment. And whether he disagreed, he respected it with my opinion. He understood some of the viewpoints. And whether or not he went to vote against or for the policy that I was pushing, I mean, I took the chance to meet with him. I'm going to take every shot and every opportunity I can. And I don't think that alienating half of America is going to be positive, because if you truly want to change, then you're going to look and you're going to try to talk to all of America.
Absolutely. What do you think of the walkouts in support of the Second Amendment that took place, just in late April?
I mean, since the beginning, I've been very headstrong about what I think. I don't think that walkouts do anything. I think it's for PR and publicity. And you can do that if you're going for PR and publicity, but if in reality you're trying to push policy and make sure that something that my school never happens again, then you go to legislators. You don't waste your time protesting to get views or clicks for mainstream media. You go talk to your politicians. You go talk to your state legislators. You do a town hall. Doing a walkout doesn't do anything. It creates confusion in your school system, and it doesn't do anything. Like, tell me what a walkout has accomplished. I have not seen a single thing that a walkout has truly accomplished. What I've seen is talking to legislators, either from the left or the right, is what gets things done.
Yeah. So are you hoping to take what you've done and tell other teenagers, give them advice, give them lessons on actually how to be politically effective?
Well, look, I don't think I'm a professional in any way, shape, or form in this.
You have to be, though, honestly.
I mean, I just think that you have to look at it rationally and be like, look, at the end of the day, senators are still people. They have logic, they have emotion, and they understand the situations and consequences of their actions. They understand what policy effects and the day-to-day struggles of people. I can tell you that every Republican senator I've talked to truly cares about this. 100%, they never want to see this ever happen again. And talking to them has shown me that they don't ever want this to happen again.
Talking again with the Kyle Kashuv, and what happens next for you, Kyle? I mean, where do you want to go?
Yesterday I got on board with Charlie Kirk and The Turning Point. I'm the director for high school outreach, and I think it's amazing, and I really hope to empower students. I use the term empowering somewhat cliche, but I really hope to make Republicans feel safe and secure to speak out. And I've seen that even at my school, Republicans are scared to speak out, and they're silenced, and people have told me, oh, Kyle, after all this, I feel more comfortable talking about political positions.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. You're making a difference.
To me, throughout all the hate, people have come up to me and said, yo, Kyle, thank you for what you're doing. I don't feel as like threatened or intimidated now because you've spoken up and you've taken all the weight. And I think that's great. I'm willing to take the weight if it allows one person to feel more comfortable.
Yeah. So I got to ask, how did you end up here at the NRA annual meeting?
Look, man, I mean, definitely. The NRA, definitely the president speaking was like, now I have to go. Like, the VP and Trump speaking, you can't miss it out. Pence was absolutely amazing. The entire crowd was absolutely energetic, and the president did amazing as well.
Yeah. So are you going to be old enough to vote in November?
No, I'm going to be 17.
Okay. What is your message? I mean, obviously you've got a lot of gun control supporters who are out there trying to register people the day they turn 18. What is your message as the director of high school outreach now about the importance of these November elections if you're old enough to vote?
We have to win.
Top of the hour, Chuck Michelle joins us here on Cam and Company talking about the micro-stamping lawsuit. California State Supreme Court yesterday deciding that just because it's impossible to comply with the law, that's no reason to take a law off the books. No, I guess establishing catch-22 there in the state constitution. Want to welcome to the program right now from out in Chesterfield, Virginia, suburb of Richmond, Virginia, where the NRA Carry Guard Expo, by the way, is coming up here in just a matter of months. Want to welcome from TAC Solutions, David Van Buren is with us. David, how are you, sir?
Fine, Cam. How you doing today?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. It's good to see you, and it was great to see your name in print the other day. I ran across the story out of the Chesterfield paper talking about
armed mentors, which is an interesting concept and one that I've not heard really discussed in Virginia. So this would put, you've got 10 elementary schools there in Chesterfield, and this would put retired law enforcement in every one. Dave, is that right?
That's what they want to do. Our elementary schools have currently have no armed security in them, the middle schools and high schools. And the superintendent of the Chesterfield schools told me a couple years ago that their plan was they would call over to the middle school and then have the security officer respond. That's probably a 4 to 8 minute response time, and that's the incident's going to be over.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 4 to 8 minutes, you know, you're probably going to be able to get local law enforcement, you know, not even the school, a security resource officer, but local law enforcement going to be able to arrive there within that same period of time. But that's still 4 to 8 minutes too long. Explain how this would work, David. These would be retired officers. They would be armed, but they would not be school resource officers. So they're not there to stop fights or deal with, you know, when a kid flips out in a classroom. That's not what they're there for.
That's correct. My understanding of this, Cam, is they're there specifically for any armed threat that would enter the school. Now, the big debate in Chesterfield is, do we make them uniform or do we make them plain clothes? And anybody that carries concealed knows that if you carry open, you're giving up your tactical advantage immediately. It puts you in a really bad situation where an officer, and as a 26-year veteran of Richmond Police Department, you have that uniform on. I know you're wearing a neon sign. If you're someplace where an armed assailant is, shoot me first. So I think the element of surprise of the general public not knowing who that mentor is and being able to carry concealed is going to provide much more better protection for the children and for the teachers and anybody at the school.
All right, David, I know that you're a resident there, but you're not a spokesman for this proposal or anything like that. But I want to quote a couple of opponents of this and just get your thoughts on what they had to say. Sarah Ward is a resident in Lothian, Virginia. She says, quote, "I think it's overkill for small children. I don't see why it would be necessary. Our schools are very safe. Virginia has probably been a leader in that because of what happened at Virginia Tech. Virginia has a lot of threat assessment tools in their toolbox." And she also said the school resource officer program is something that's been vetted. It's been effective. There are lots of requirements for an SRO, but she just doesn't like the idea of having, armed guards, even retired police officers there in Virginia because our schools are safe, she says.
Well, I probably felt like they were safe in Sandy Hook the morning that incident happened too. And we all walk around in this bubble thinking everywhere we go, everything we do, our children are safe and we don't have to worry about them. And I have the concern I have about this and the line of thought I've gotten is, why are we making our children afraid of the police? If a police officer walks in there armed or is carrying concealed, why should those children fear him? They're there to protect them and help them. And the kind of the takeaway from that is, well, are we willing to sacrifice, number one, someone who's unarmed if an attacker comes in, and number two, our children?
Talking again with David Van Buren from TAC Solutions there in Chesterfield, Virginia. Now, there was another quote in the local Chesterfield paper. Lori Haas, who is with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, said, quote, "What we need, as opposed to this armed mentor program, what we need are extreme risk laws like those that have passed in numerous states that would allow police or family members to petition a state court to order the removal of firearms from individuals considered a danger to themselves or others." She went on to say, quote, "To say that bringing firearms into schools is somehow going to make them safer is false." Now, David, I understand that, you know, Lori Haas is a gun control advocate.
Yes, sir, she is.
But, I mean, if that's your standpoint, are you advocating not just to not have this armed mentor program, but are you advocating to remove the school resource officers from the middle and high schools? Because those two are, you know, these are officers that are bringing firearms into schools there. Is that making those schools more dangerous?
No. And you know, the bad guys have never followed the laws. You can make all the laws you want. You can make it as restrictive as you want. And the bad guys, the criminals, are always going to have weapons. Now, John Lotz Institute, says that 13.5% of people that carry have intervened in active shooter incidents. There was an article in the Washington Post recently that said 25 states allow teachers and staff to carry concealed on property and there's not been one incident of any active shooter in any of those localities that allow that. And I don't understand where the fear is, because, again, you're talking about officers who have given their life to serving the public and protecting the public, and now we're saying, well, we can't trust them now that they're off duty, and we'll just make more laws. And Cam, and you and I both know that generally the laws do not affect the criminals at all. They affect all the people who are trying to abide by the laws.
Absolutely. Again, talking with David Van Buren of TAC Solutions there in Chesterfield, Virginia. So it sounds like, I know there was a meeting of one of the working groups with the school board this week talking about this subject, but it kind of sounds like this may not get a final vote for a couple of months there in Chesterfield. Have you heard what kind of timeline they're working on? Would they like to have this program in place when kids go back to school in the fall?
They would like to have it in place when they go back. The problem is the discussions like you and I are having and the other people are having, we got to look at the facts. I look at things strategically. Do we want to protect our children? The best way to protect them is to have someone in that school that's armed, that knows what they're doing. So if an assailant comes through that door, we don't see another tragic event, because that trained person has the opportunity to stop the assailant as quick as possible. And it just bothers me that we're having the discussion that, again, are our children afraid of the police officers? These police officers are sworn to protect the public. They're not going to harm our children. They're there to protect everybody that's in the school.
Absolutely. Well, David, listen, again, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. As this continues being debated in Chesterfield, I hope that we can have you back on and give our best to the lovely Dee Dee Van Buren as well. Will you please, sir?
I will. I call her Miss America. I will tell her you said hi. Thanks, Cam, for the interview, and y'all have a great day.
Absolutely. You too. Thank you so much, sir. That would be David Van Buren of TAC Solutions. I don't know why I said Cameron Gray up there, but that was not Cameron Gray. Cameron Gray's in our control room. All right, coming up next hour, we have Mr. Chuck Michelle, top of the hour, talking about what happened at the California State Supreme Court yesterday. A rather bizarre ruling by the California State Supreme Court, but you know they'll go to any lengths to uphold gun control laws out there, unfortunately. So you got this microstamping law that's been on the books since 2017. No new models of semi-automatic handguns have been able to be sold in the state because the state requires them to have microstamping technology, which does not exist. And yesterday, the California State Supreme Court said, well, it doesn't really matter that it's impossible to comply with this law. That's no reason for us to throw this law out just because they passed a law that you can't comply with. Maybe at some point in the future be able to comply with the law, and then the law would be a valid law here. So nope. And in the meantime, those who are currently gun owners in California, those who would like to be gun owners in California, are faced with a restriction of their right to keep and bear arms. Now, the Supreme Court has told us what the test is as to whether or not an arm is protected under the Constitution. If it's in common use for a variety of lawful purposes, yeah, it's protected. And that's why they struck down Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns. Now, this is a ban on semi-automatic handguns by any other name. Because the roster of handguns that are approved for sale in California keeps dwindling. Because every time, again, a manufacturer makes a design tweak or modification, California's Department of Justice declares that to be a whole new, brand new semi-automatic firearm. It's got to come equipped with microstamping technology in order to be sold in the state of California. And so, boom, a gun drops off of that roster. And, you know, there's going to come a time where there aren't any semi-automatic handguns available for sale in California. They will have all been deemed unsafe for sale because of this law that's impossible to comply with. So what happens next? Again, we'll talk about it with Chuck Michelle. Coming up at the top of the hour, Carol Markowitz of the New York Post join us on the program next hour as well, talking about the erasure of history. Stephen Miller of Fox News in hour three, and Tony Katz of WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, talking about some of the big stories of the week, including Anthony Kennedy, retiring from the Supreme Court. The Hill newspaper has a story out today. Alexander Bolton says the fight to replace Anthony Kennedy expected to be the most expensive Supreme Court confirmation battle in history. Which is amazing when you think about it, Cameron, because there's all the talk about, well, there's nothing Democrats can do, right? There's nothing. I mean, Democrats, they have no tools in their toolbox. Mm-hmm. So one would think you wouldn't have to spend a dime on this one. But, right. Nope, it's going to be the most expensive confirmation fight in history.
And that, remember, some big money is okay. It just depends on where it comes from.
That's right. That's right. It's only dark money when it's coming, you know, for causes that you don't like. If it's a cause that you love,
it's happy money.
Then even if it's, you know, 501c4, exactly, it's sunshine cash. That's all it is. It's just sunshine cash. And every time you spend sunshine cash, the world gets a little bit better and brighter. Mm-hmm. That's how it works. Robert McGuire, who tracks spending by political nonprofits at the Center for Responsive Politics, says, I would not be surprised at all if it not only set a record, but we saw far more spending than we saw in past Supreme Court battles. He says, we're seeing groups gear up faster than they have in the past. These groups are well-funded. They can raise money for this, something that wealthy donors are very passionate about. Yes. This is something that people are going to be very passionate about. Again, if you read folks on the left, if Donald Trump is allowed to replace the retiring Anthony Kennedy, then it's bye-bye democracy. The Washington Post is going to have to find a new masthead because democracy will have died in darkness. So that's what they feel is at stake here. As a matter of fact, there is another warning from the gun control groups that the Second Amendment could be untouchable if a replacement for Anthony Kennedy gets confirmed. We'll talk about that next hour as well. Stick around. Hour two of Cam and Company is coming up right after this.
I want to go back to what you talked about with the Constitution and what we are teaching and what we're not teaching. Because, you know, surrounding this gun control argument, it's not even really been a debate, but the argument over the last couple of months, I keep hearing, in fact, I saw it on my Twitter feed earlier today, one of these common talking points from anti-gun advocates is, well, listen, the Constitution's old, Lucretia. It was written in 1791, and founding fathers couldn't have envisioned what guns would look like. And by the way, back then, you know, that same Constitution, those same founding fathers, you talked about our freedom of speech and talked about our right to keep and bear arms. They also said that you were 3/5 of a person, right?
Yeah.
And so why should we listen to the Constitution? Why should we hold this up as some sort of revered document when clearly it was written with flaws in it? We've changed, we've progressed, we've moved on past these things. Why can't we move past the Second Amendment too?
Because our founding fathers were smarter than what we have in Washington today. It's like they had a crystal ball and they saw the tyranny that was going to happen 200 years later. So the only thing that is stopping us from losing our sovereignty, and the only thing stopping from Washington, D.C. from getting complete out control is the Bill of Rights, the Constitution of the United States. That's what's stopping them from taking us over from within. As long as we have the Constitution, we'll never be overtaken.
You know, and I'm so glad to hear you say that, because you're absolutely right. The Constitution, when it was presented to the American people back in 1787, there were a lot of people who were skeptical about it. There were a lot of people who said, whoa, this gives the federal government way, way too much power. I don't know if I'm on board with this, which is why we have a Bill of Rights. There were enough states that said, we're not going to ratify the Constitution unless we get some guarantees here that our rights are going to be protected. And if you read the preamble to the Bill of Rights, which nobody ever does, it actually talks about why we've got the Bill of Rights in the first place. They say to ensure that the government could not take these liberties, that to reassure the American people that their rights were going to be respected. That's why we have the Bill of Rights. And it's not that the government said, hey, you know what, we're putting together this whole new document. Let's come up with some new rights for you, too. These were rights that Americans already possessed. These were rights that Americans did not want to lose. And what we have seen over the past 230-plus years is that the rights have been expanded to include all Americans. It's true that at the time of the founding of this nation, basically people like me were the only ones who really got to exercise their rights.
Mm-hmm.
White guys who own property, right?
Who cares?
But
black men that own property. One of the first slave owners was a black man. If we're going to talk about history, let's go tit for tat. You want to talk about all the evil in the world? Let's go back to Cain and Abel. Let's get serious. We live in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
We have a document that is a living, breathing document. Leave it alone. The first 12 amendments is the Bill of Rights. If you want to amend, you want to change it, then you go ahead and you amend it. But you're going to do it in order, in law, the way it's supposed to be. You're not going to get rid of the first 12 amendments. Let it go, because I will walk on Washington myself before I allow that to happen. I'm fighting for the next generation, and I could care less about what happened in the past, because we cannot go and change it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and here's the thing. But we have changed the present. We have changed the future. And what we have seen over our U.S. history is that expansion of rights, that recognition of, all right, you know what, it's not just a right of white guys who own property. It's not just a right of people, of men who own property. These rights are rights of all Americans. And you know what? I think the country has become a better place. Not a worse place, as more and more of us have been able to exercise our rights as Americans. And it does concern me that we now have people who are fighting to take those rights away, who say that, well, you know what, no, we were better off when we didn't have these rights. We were better off when we were able to say, you know what, you get to exercise that right, but you don't get to exercise that right.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right now. Coming up in hour three, we've got our hero of the day, deal of the day. Good guys, Stephen Miller of FoxNews.com. Tony Katz going to close us out this afternoon. Also coming up this hour, Carol Markowitz at the New York Post joins us. And momentarily, we'll be speaking with Mr. Chuck Michel of Michel & Associates about what happened in California with the micro-stamping lawsuit that's been going on for years. I mean, this law was passed. I think it went into effect in 2010. It may have been passed, I want to say 2007. And again, back then, firearms manufacturers said there's no way we can comply with this law. There were competing bills in California, by the way. It was between micro stamping and this other non-existent technology called bullet serialization. And the anti-gun lawmakers in California were trying to decide what non-existent technology they would require manufacturers to come up with, either fire manufacturers to comply with micro stamping or ammunition manufacturers come up with a way to serialize ammunition. Yeah. And the idea was, well, there's got to be some sort of way to use a laser to etch a unique identifier on each round of ammunition so that, you know, once a gun is fired, there's some sort of identifier on the shell casing. Yeah, that again, an incredibly stupid idea. They went with the also incredibly stupid idea of, hey, let's figure out a way. That's not even figure out a way. Let's just tell manufacturers to figure out a way so that every time a gun is fired, this unique code is stamped in two different places on the shell casing. And if you can't do that, then you can't sell your semi-automatic handgun in the state of California. Join us to talk about this, Chuck Michel from Michel & Associates out in California. Chuck, how are you this afternoon?
Good, Cam. How are you?
I'm okay.
Just another crazy day in California.
Yeah. I mean, listen, this is how crazy it is. The California State Supreme Court says the state can pass an impossible law, a law that you absolutely cannot comply with, and that's no reason for us to throw the law out.
Right. What they're saying is impossibility might be an excuse if you break the law. For example, if you missed a deadline or something because it was impossible to comply with it, that might be an excuse for missing a deadline. But when it comes to a statute that's impossible to comply with, like this one, you can't go in and ask a court to say that that's not a law that you have to comply with. So this is talk about a catch-22, and it's impossible to actually produce these guns or sell these guns in California. You're going to get prosecuted if you try and sell a gun without this micro stamping on it. So it's more of the California rigged system against gun owners. And God help us, I just hope we can get a case to the Supreme Court that makes clear that these kind of laws can't be passed.
Absolutely. And before we get to the next steps here, you know, I want to understand, or I want to explain to people who may not understand here. So in California, in order for a gun to be sold, a handgun to be sold, it has to be on this roster of approved handguns. And now any new model has to have the non-existent micro-stamping technology. So there have been no new models introduced into California since when, Chuck? Since 2010?
And the roster of firearms keeps shrinking. Handguns that you can actually go into a store and buy keeps shrinking. So there are less and less model handguns available for sale in California because you can't get them on that list without this impossible to do micro stamping technology. So it's a great rigged game for the folks who don't want people to be able to buy handguns. And any handgun manufacturer that's basically grandfathered onto the list, if they let their gun fall off the list, and DOJ doesn't go out of their way to tell people that you have to send in your annual check to keep your gun on the roster, if you accidentally fall off the list, you can't get back on. So the list doesn't grow, but it does keep shrinking.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the other thing. This is a gun ban by any other name. It's not we're going to ban every one of these semi-automatic firearms in one big grab, but over time that number of firearms available for sale is going to continue to drop because, as you say, anytime there's sort of a design modification, you put a pin somewhere or you remove a pin, doesn't change the function of the firearm, but Cal DOJ says that's a whole new model right there. Where's your micro stamping?
That's the true
sooner
irony
or later,
of this.
You're going to be left with no semi-automatic firearms available for sale or no semi-automatic handguns.
Exactly. Or you'll be left with ones that are basically frozen in time back around 2010 because, you know, even on an existing model gun, even if they don't change the model number, they'll sometimes make minor improvements as they get guns back for a warranty repair. They see, hey, we should have tightened this spring up a little or used a different screw here or filed this down a little here to make it work more smoothly. And then on that model, as the gun is continued to be produced, they've made those little adjustments. Well, according to DOJ, even though the model number doesn't change, that's a new model under the law, and so it can't be sold as improved. So ironically, better guns of existing models, the better versions, the improved versions of those guns are illegal in California as well. You're stuck with the addition, so to speak, the version of the gun that was originally produced and originally approved for inclusion on the roster. So it's ridiculous. The manufacturers have to basically produce two different versions of the same model, one for California. But they can't produce one with micro-stamping because it's impossible.
Exactly. And as you say, ultimately, this roster is supposed to be about handguns that are deemed safe for sale. Meanwhile, as safety improves, those firearms are not going to be able to be sold in California. So much for gun safety. So Chuck, what are the next steps? I mean, this was the California State Supreme Court issuing this decision. So remedy in state court appears to be a null and void here. Is there a way to raise similar challenges or other challenges to this same law via the federal courts?
Yes. I mean, remember, this was the National Shooting Sports Foundations. Our friends over there brought this. That's the trade association for gun manufacturers. And this really was a manufacturer's issue. We supported them and their efforts, but this was not a Second Amendment challenge. And so now I suspect that the NRA will be looking at and probably bringing a Second Amendment challenge because this is basically a handgun ban. And the question needs to be answered. You know, when Heller said that you had a fundamental right to have a handgun to defend yourself, did they mean just one model handgun? Does it have to be a semi-auto? Does it have to be a wheel gun, a revolver? Aren't you entitled to the spectrum of handguns and to choose from the ones that consumers use for lawful purposes? We think you are, and we think now with a new Supreme Court, perhaps we're going to be. It's going to be a lot more likely that the Supreme Court will agree with us.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, something we've been talking about all week long, the possibility of a replacement for Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. We know that it's been 8 years since the courts heard a Second Amendment case. We know it takes four justices to hear a case. 10 years since Heller, 8 years since McDonald, right?
Right. Yes.
Okay. So, and again, yeah, there's been that roadblock, right? We haven't had those four justices who've apparently been wanting to hear one of these cases. And we don't really know why. But we know that we've heard from Justice Gorsuch, we've heard from Justice Thomas, Justice Alito has made some comments in opinions that, you know, we really should be hearing these cases.
Right.
So we know that there are those three voices out there that have been saying, all right, it's time to hear another case. Hopefully now we are going to get to see a court with a renewed interest in the Second Amendment. I will say, Chuck, the gun control advocates are freaking out about this. I saw a piece at the Trace
earlier today, the Bloomberg-backed website, quoting a law professor, anti-gun law professor, who basically said the Second Amendment is going to be stronger than ever 5 years from now, from his mouth to the justice's ears. But, it's not a done deal yet, right?
I saw that on HuffPo, too, the Huffington Post. That was, I must say I took great pleasure in them pronouncing the death of gun control. I think that's, you know, when Heller passed, we said this isn't the end, it's just the end of the beginning. Well, for the last 10 years, we've had the middle, and now hopefully we're getting into the beginning of the end. But that beginning of the end could take 10 years to get us through the process or more. I mean, that's been the historical pace with, for example, First Amendment litigation. So, we'll see now. Remember, it takes 4 votes to take a case, 5 votes to win. So we think that our 4 friends on the Supreme Court were probably voting against taking cases because they didn't know what Kennedy would do. Now, with a new justice on that court, we think we'll have the 4 to not only the 4 to take a case, but the 5 to win a case. The only question mark is Justice Roberts now, who may become the new swing vote on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and I you're right. I think that's a fair question because we also have not seen Justice Roberts sign on to any of those dissents urging the court to take a case. And I don't know if he's done that in other issues or if that's just something he thinks as the Chief Justice he should shy away from doing. I honestly don't know. I do know, though, that, you, along with every other gun owner out there, hopes that this is going to be a new day for the Supreme Court. And again, you know, when you look at all of the laws and all of the lawsuits, Chuck, just out of California that are in the federal pipeline, you've got the magazine ban. Right. That's still before a federal judge.
Yep.
You've got the right to carry the case, the follow up to the Peruta case. How many other cases do you have right now in federal court out there in California?
Well, remember, there's probably half a dozen licensed carry in public cases working their way through the district courts across the country, not just in California, but the NRA. You know, it's a national game. It's not just a California game. And any win in any jurisdiction is a win for California, too, because it sets national precedent. But there are about half a dozen licensed carry cases. We've got 2 challenges to the semi-auto bans out in California, a regulatory challenge and a Second Amendment challenge. We've got 2 cases going on right now on the ban on the possession of magazines. We've got a challenge to the fees imposed on gun buyers when they purchase a handgun or a firearm. And there's some others that I'm forgetting right now. But we're also queued up to file a few more. The state is getting ready to pass a ban on 18 to 21-year-olds buying any kind of firearm. And that's already being challenged by the NRA in Florida. Again, if we win in Florida, that's a national precedent. But we'll probably wind up filing that in California. There's also this issue with gun shows, which is classic viewpoint discrimination, where folks don't want to have gun shows because they don't like the message. They don't want to glorify guns. And thankfully, we just beat a couple of those back down in Orange County and in Del Mar Fairgrounds to stop folks who wanted to ban the shows there. But when one will probably pass, there's a legislation pending to ban gun shows at the Cow Palace, and that's state legislation. And if that passes, I expect there'll be a lawsuit there, too.
I suspect that you're right. Now, speaking of the gun shows, Chuck, there's an update, right? Orange County that finally gave approval to holding gun shows there on county property?
Right. You know, the gun ban lobby has been very much emboldened lately. With the composition of the state legislature, and not the least of which by Gavin Newsom's whipping up the troops, so to speak, against the NRA and against guns in general. And so they organized an effort to try and ban gun shows at 2 venues in Orange County, one in Del Mar Fairgrounds and one in the Orange County Fairgrounds. That had been put on by the Crossroads of the West gun shows for 30 years, you know, without incident. And gun shows in California are some of the most heavily regulated events in the country. I mean, a few years ago, they passed a whole litany of regulations over gun shows, including new security requirements and all kinds of things. But that wasn't enough. And they're wildly popular. People line up for hours to get into these shows. But a few folks, very vocal folks down in that, in those jurisdictions, wanted to ban them and got it in front of the board, the regulatory board. And there was a vote yesterday to allow those guns, at least at the Orange County Fairgrounds, to allow those gun shows to go forward. So that's a pretty big win without having to go to court to do it. You know, we have to fight on all fronts. Litigation is not a magic bullet. Second Amendment litigation is not a magic bullet. You have to fight on every battleground that you can, and ultimately, hopefully, the Supreme Court will help us win the war.
Absolutely. Chuck Michelle, it's good talking with you this afternoon, sir. Thanks for everything you're doing out there in California, and thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for getting the word out, Cam.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Mr. Chuck Michelle with us here on Michelle & Associates. Mr. Incredible. Doesn't Chuck Berry strike in resemblance to Mr. Incredible, Cameron, from The Incredibles? I
never saw The Incredibles.
You've never seen it?
No. So I'm going to say yes, Cam.
Yes.
Exactly.
Say yes. That's all you need to say. Exactly.
Uncanny.
All right. Still to come, Carol Markowitz of the New York Post will join us on the program. Why don't we take a quick timeout? We'll be back with more right after this. I just saw a new poll out from Gallup. It's the summer season, and so I guess we get some wide-open generic polls. The questions asked by Gallup this time around, is it morally okay to do blank? Is it morally okay? They specifically asked about 22 behaviors. Birth control, drinking alcohol, divorce, sex between an unmarried man and woman, gambling, gay or lesbian relations, medical research using stem cells obtained from human embryos, smoking marijuana, having a baby outside of marriage, the death penalty, buying and wearing clothing made of animal fur, medical testing on animals, doctor-assisted suicide, abortion, pornography, sex between teenagers, cloning animals, suicide, polygamy, cloning humans, and married men and women having an affair. Now, some good news here. Not everything on that list was deemed to be morally acceptable by the American people. So we do still have some standards. That's good. And I thought this was fascinating. I kind of wish that they'd actually asked about owning a firearm and how many Americans thought that that was morally acceptable. Because I'd love to see all those individuals who claim to be Second Amendment supporters just in favor of a few common sense gun safety regulations. We actually say, no, it's morally unacceptable to be a gun owner. They're there. You know they're out there. But Gallup did not ask about owning a firearm. Buying and wearing clothing made of animal fur. Now, they didn't ask about hunting. This would be the closest comparison to hunting that they asked about. And honestly, I would suspect that if they had polled on hunting, it would have proven to be even more morally acceptable than buying and wearing clothing made of animal fur. Because in that case, you're actually hunting the animal yourself, right? This is just walking into a store, picking out a fur coat or a fur hat or whatever. I'm curious, Cameron, we'll play pop quiz here. What percentage of Americans do you think said it was morally acceptable to buy and wear clothing made of animal fur?
Knowing that the number has... it's gone down recent years because fur is generally looked upon negatively. I'm going to say 20%.
No.
Okay.
60%.
Oh, then I'm completely off. Wow.
60% said it was morally acceptable.
Wow.
To buy and wear clothing made of animal fur. Only 37% said it was not morally acceptable. I know. I was kind of surprised by that, too. Now, I will say this polling by Gallup shows a fairly libertarian-minded America here. Let's see. Smoking marijuana, 65% of Americans said morally acceptable. Drinking alcohol, 78% morally acceptable. Gambling, 69% morally acceptable. Sex between an unmarried man and woman, 69% finds it morally acceptable. When you get down to abortion, that's the first issue that does not gain more than 50% of Americans in this polling saying that it is morally acceptable.
That's where you start to go underwater. 43% of Americans responding to this poll said, yes, abortion is morally acceptable. 48%, no, it's not. Pornography, 43% morally acceptable. 55%, no, it's not. Down to married men and women having an affair, 10% says, yes, that's acceptable. 88% say, no, it's not morally acceptable. Cloning humans, 16%, morally acceptable. 81%, not morally acceptable. Polygamy, 19% morally acceptable, 78% not acceptable. So, again, there are still some things that Americans, by and large, say, no, we're not on board with that. But it is kind of surprising. Again, given the scolding nature of the left and their allies in the press and in the entertainment industry and certainly in politics, you can't do that. We don't want you to do that. We don't want you to do that either, right? All of these areas of our individual liberty and freedom confined to a smaller and smaller space. And, I mean, to me, my top-line takeaway from this polling is there are an awful lot of Americans who really do subscribe to the attitude of leave me alone, and I'll leave you alone. Welcome back. It is Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad to be with you today. And glad to have with us from the New York Post, Carol Markowitz is with us. Carol, how are you?
Hi, Cam. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. Glad you could join us. I was glad to see you writing about this. I know that in the hyper-crazy news cycle we live in, we've maybe moved on from Laura Ingalls Wilder, but this is going to come back. We're going to see another. There's going to be another author. There's going to be another award that we're going to have to take away. A division of the American Library Association, you write, has voted to remove Laura Ingalls Wilder's name from a major children's book award. Why, Carol?
Well, it turns out that Laura Ingalls Wilder, when she lived on the frontier with her family, had some questionable opinions, or even not even that her own opinions, but the way she described Native Americans and African Americans was in line with the time. And in our new modern age, where we clean up history to reflect our own modernity, that's no longer acceptable.
Yeah, according to the American Library Association, her work contains, quote, expressions of stereotypical attitudes inconsistent with ALSC's core values of inclusiveness, integrity, and respect, and responsiveness. Okay, so here's my question, Carol. Like, yes, I agree. We've likely moved on from social attitudes of Laura Ingalls Wilder's time. So does that mean we can't read her anymore, or does that mean that you read her and then you teach this in context?
Right. Well, it's going ahead in that direction. Absolutely. There's enough schools that have banned Huckleberry Finn to know that Laura Ingalls Wilder does not have a lot of time left on school bookshelves. But the changing the name of the award means that she has done something wrong, like that she has wronged us somehow, and that she can no longer represent good American literature, which is what the award was for. And that's really depressing, because she's such an icon in American literature. Kids read her all the time, and they have. She died in 1957, so quite a while ago now, and yet she remains extremely relevant. Her writing is extremely relevant, and to whitewash it because she wasn't woke enough is a dangerous road for us to be on.
It really is, and I don't see it stopping here. In fact, what's interesting is that there really wasn't, it sounds like there wasn't really even any pushback from folks within the Library Association.
Right. So in my article, I mentioned that the only negative that they could come up with, they're discussing this and they're like, well, what would be the negative of changing the name? And the only negative that they come up with is, in changing the name, we're going to have to use the name to say why we're not using the name. And that's the negative. So it's really sad that there wasn't more pushback because of it.
It is. And I just have to highlight the Kafkaesque language that you just referred to. I just have to quote this. The disadvantage in changing the name is that the old name, which has painful associations for many, must continue to be referenced by the ALSC in the interest of communication and transparency regarding the change. So, I don't want to make light of anybody, Carol, but really, hearing the name Laura Ingalls Wilder
It
makes people feel pain, really?
Right, right. It's so bonkers. Yeah, and again, that it's the same conversation as with the statues. You know, it started with the Confederate statues, but then before long, it was already Thomas Jefferson's statue was, you know, under protest, and other icons of history who didn't live our modern standards are now targeted too. And again, we're living. It's such a bad thing to do because we're not fixing history. History is what it is. And we can celebrate people while knowing that they had plenty of drawbacks. And if we're going to try to sanitize history, that we're going to have no statues left. There's not going to be any books to read because history has had its problems and we have to recognize that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, look, I mean, we do live in a day and age, too, I think, where there's also this sort of this is self-censorship. This is not coming from any sort of government edict or government mandate.
Right.
But it also is not only confined to the American Library Association. I mean, you have publishing houses that are now saying, all right, you know, we're going to look for a more diverse viewpoints. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Other than saying that, you know, even if it's a not as good a book as somebody else, you know, let's say a published author who we know has got a great book and we really like it. But boy, they just, you know, they're a little too waspish for us. So we're going to go with another book instead, even though we think it's not going to sell as well. I mean, you know, those types of decisions are being made. Absolutely they are.
And even not to take it to a very far out degree, I'm friends with an author, maybe I shouldn't say his name, but he wrote a lot of books that became pretty big from the perspective of girls. And then he wrote one from the perspective of a boy. And the pushback he got was, well, we don't need to hear from boys right now. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing.
Right.
You know, and look,
so
I mean,
it's not like, yeah, it's not just by race or, you know, having the wrong opinions. It's literally like just we don't need to hear from boys. So.
You know, I mean, thankfully, we live in a day and age where you can self-publish and there are some other options out there.
Right.
And you know, we've even seen some pretty big successes in the world of self-publishing. But but from an industry perspective, this isn't healthy. And I know that you and I have talked before, Carol. I mean, your parents were from the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And you know, you write about that perspective. Obviously, when you look at a socialist nation or a union of Soviet socialist republics, you can walk down to the bookstore and pick out any book you wanted. Again, this was state-sanctioned censorship.
Right.
There are right ideas and there are wrong ideas, and why on earth would we want to expose anybody to the wrong ideas? It's the same attitude. It's just the authority is coming from the private sector versus the public sector.
Yeah, exactly. The public sector is self-censoring at this point just to not have any kind of outcry at all about anything. And that sanitizing is just, it's going to lead to a boring world where everything's written from just the, you know, the perspective, the liberal perspective, the one perspective that is still allowed.
Talking again with Carol Markowitz of the New York Post, who I appreciate you coming on the program, Carol. Now, I've got to ask you as well, while we've got you here, before we let you go, one last question. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has she been a Queen Empress of New York City yet? I know she just won a primary on Tuesday, but.
I've already heard talk about her for president, so.
See, we were talking earlier in the show, and I said if the Democrats were to take back Congress in the fall, there would be a push to name her Speaker of the House.
Right.
I guarantee it.
It's meteoric rise.
Last time New York City went crazy for somebody like this, it was the Ghostbusters. And that was fictional. So there you go. Carol, listen, thank you again for
thank
coming
you
on the
so
program.
Much,
we'll talk soon. Make sure you're following Carol on Twitter at Carol, K-A-R-O-L. Where's Joe Franklin, Cameron, talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
God, I miss Joe Franklin. Those are the days.
I heard, I was driving home the other night, and I was listening to, I think it was one of the comedy channels on Sirius XM, and it was Billy Crystal at the Bottom Line Comedy Club in like 1985.
Oh,
so it was
God.
The height of, you know, you look marvelous.
Right.
And he's doing this whole riff that was really funny. But I'm sure it would have been even funnier if guy didn't get half the jokes, because it was all about growing up in New York. And he was doing these commercials. He was just doing the voices of all of these, you know, famous commercials in New York. And I wanted to be like 12 years old and hold a microphone up to the radio and tape it for you, right, so you could hear this bit. Because you would have loved it. You would have gotten every one of those jokes.
When Billy Crystal used to do Joe Franklin on Saturday Night Live, and it was, I don't know how anyone out of New York cared or appreciated any of it, because it was the most, as you know, New York kid as I was, it was like ridiculously over New York. And I understand people from New York are very proud and everything has to be about them. But man, that was some funny stuff. And rest in peace, Joe Franklin. What a classic.
Rest in peace. There you go. All right, we've got more of the news of the day for you coming up on the program this afternoon. Also, top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. Barack Obama, according to the Huffington Post, talking at a DNC fundraiser in Southern California today, sharing the stage with DNC Chair Tom Perez. As reported by Politico, he said there is a fundamental contrast, Barack Obama did, to how we view the world. We are seeing the consequences of when one vision is realized or one vision is in charge, criticizing the Trump's administration's, quote, divisive and inflammatory rhetoric, saying Americans, quote, prefer a story of hope in a country that comes together rather than being divided. He said the majority of the country doesn't want to see a dog-eat-dog world where everybody's angry all the time. I would agree with that. But I think he's kind of misdiagnosing the problem. Again, this is at a DNC fundraiser, so one would not expect a great deal of introspection from the former president. He said, quote, the Democrats' job is not to exaggerate. The Democrats' job is not to simply mimic the tactics of the other side. All we have to do is work hard on behalf of that truth. And if we do, we'll get better outcomes. Huffington Post says Obama did not mention the week's biggest election story, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Also skipped discussion of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement. But he did talk about the shooting at the Capitol Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland yesterday. And he said, quote, each time one of these tragedies strikes, we remind ourselves that this is preventable. America is not the only nation on earth that has people who are troubled or violent, but we are unique in the weapons that those people can deploy, and it is costly. Again, according to authorities yesterday, the weapon of choice for this man in Annapolis, Maryland, was a pump-action shotgun. The very kind of gun, by the way, that Barack Obama's Vice President Joe Biden told Americans to go out and buy instead of the semi-automatic rifles that Joe Biden and Barack Obama wanted to ban. Do you recall Joe Biden's get a shotgun comment? Do you remember that, Cameron? Seems so long ago.
It does. As Ed said, a trillion news cycles ago.
A trillion news cycles ago, yes. But in the distant recesses of my mind, I seem to recall something about Joe Biden saying, get a shotgun, get a shotgun. And so, again, Barack Obama, like every other politician out there who's calling for more gun control, doesn't want to get specific. He can't talk about what law should have been on the books in Maryland that wasn't on the books, or what law should have been on the books in the federal code that wasn't on the books that would have stopped this attack. You know, we talked with Ed Morrissey earlier this program, about the background here of this individual, which goes back to 2011, goes back to a stalking charge that this individual was facing after stalking a woman there in Maryland. That's a felony charge. It got pled down to a misdemeanor, harassment charge. The judge granted probation in the case. And the case was, because the probation was granted before the a case was finally concluded, this was basically expunged off his record. So we can talk about the existing laws, which, by the way, Barack Obama doesn't want to talk about. Gun control activists don't want to talk about. Because there's really no soundbite solution for this genuine problem here of individuals getting off with a slap on the wrist. And what happened after this individual got that plea bargain? According to the victim, who moved out of state and who now sleeps with a gun by her side, this guy turned his attention from her to the paper. And you've got former employees of the paper who said, yeah, we were concerned about this. I told our lawyers, he's going to be the next mass shooter. But ultimately, they decided not to go forward with a restraining order. They decided not to move forward with perhaps additional charges. Again, we don't know why. But one of the reasons why may very well have been, well, look what happened the last time. He was charged with a felony. He pled down to a misdemeanor. He got probation. So if we do this, if we escalate, if we respond, are we giving him the attention that he wants? And what's going to be the consequence? What's actually going to happen? What's really going to happen here? If we pursue this to the utmost vigor, what's going to happen? We're going to get a piece of paper that says he has to leave us alone. Well, what happens if he violates the piece of paper? He might get probation. You might get a weekend in jail. Is that going to make things better or is that going to make things worse? You know, they don't want to talk about the specifics of this case because the specifics of this case, as frequently as they might be found in courtrooms across the country, don't really offer any easy solutions. We have to talk about the criminal justice system. We have to talk about criminal justice reform, not just in terms of reducing these sentences for nonviolent offenders, but reducing the number of plea bargains that are offered for violent offenders. And if it was inappropriate for this individual, let's make the case, it was inappropriate for this individual to be charged with a felony, to go to prison, and he needed mental health help instead. Well, that didn't happen either. That didn't happen either. Which is not something that Barack Obama mentioned at that DNC fundraiser. Again, it was all about the soundbite solution of let's do something with gun control. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we return, we've got more of the day's top stories right here on Cam and Company. Stick around. We'll be back with much more right after this. The Sheriff of Jackson County, Texas, Sheriff A.J. Andy Lauterbach is with us. Sheriff, I know that you have been working very closely with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick there in Texas on Governor Abbott's School Safety Action Plan. We've been talking about this School Safety Action Plan throughout the course of the week since this has been released. And I got to tell you, Sheriff, I mean, reading this, this is a beefy document. I mean, there are dozens of specific policy proposals, specific action plans here. So it's not just a matter of, well, what if we did this? This is a document that's here's what we're doing. And I just want to get your overall thoughts on some of the items contained there in that school safety action plan.
Well, yeah, I have to compliment state leadership on the quick action that they took. We have a 43-page document. You know, it's got some things in there that we believe were actionable items that we can put in place very soon. Probably one of the better areas there is the school program on a school marshal program. You know, this is starting on page 7, a very good all around program. Again, my hat's off to state leadership, Governor Abbott, the initiative, Lieutenant Governor Patrick. They've done a great job in getting the right people in the right spot as soon as possible and coming up with some things that we can start doing here before school starts.
What are some of the things specifically, Sheriff, that students and parents and staff may notice being different when they go back to school in the fall?
Well, I believe we've got certain things that are going to happen. I believe we're going to do a better job. Many districts right now are engaged in training. They've got training starting to be scheduled here in this month and next month, first part of August. So school identification, school training, some basic fundamentals of school safety are being put in place now by a lot of districts. So we've got some things that are moving in many districts across Texas. I talked to many sheriffs this week that are engaged definitely in adding the extra patrols there. Superintendents and school boards are engaged heavily on the different areas that they can do right now. This is a long-term problem. This issue is not going away. I've said this before. You know, Texas is like other states. We've got our problems, and funding is always an issue. But by God, the Texas sheriffs are engaged in this matter, and you know, we're not for this learned helplessness and enforced helplessness issue that goes on. We want to protect our kids, and we want to do it as fast and as good as we can.
Absolutely. You know, Sheriff, one of the things that is brought up in this school safety action plan is a program at Texas Tech, And apparently this is in use in school districts surrounding Texas Tech, where troubled students are identified. They can get referred to help. Apparently dozens of students have been reached in this regard. It's not a matter of, well, you know, Billy said something that people thought was a little weird, so we put him in a straitjacket and locked him up for, you know, 6 months. We're not talking about that, but we are talking about, again, the ability to identify individuals who may be in need of help. We're not saying that all of them are going to be violent school shooters, but these are individuals who can benefit from some mental health, and it's everything maybe from, you know, outpatient sessions to inpatient treatment. I'm curious your thoughts on expanding that, you know, across the state, because it sounds like Governor Abbott feels like there's been some real promise shown by this program.
Well, there has, and the Texas Tech is a good model. There's another aspect of this also where technology can play a role in the mental health and identification of a potential school shooter or someone who's thinking about committing some type of school violence. Our fusion centers in Texas, our ability to data mine open source information and get that information through an analyst into the hands of law enforcement agencies for prompt, quick action. And we have some evidence here in Texas where this is a viable area which would help in criminal justice and in identifying possible school violent people who are kids who are starting to engage in that type of behavior. And so along with the pattern from Texas Tech, which is great, a lot of mental health aspects in that. And then, of course, both programs are designed to preempt, stop someone from becoming another school shooter. So that's always the best plan. We can stop that prior to happening. So there's a lot of focus, as it should be, in that area.
Welcome back. Thanks again for joining us here on Cam and Company. Hopefully you are getting ready for a fantastic weekend, rolling into maybe even an extended weekend for you. And I will tell you, we will be on the air all next week with the exception of Independence Day. I was thinking about taking some time off, and then the time got away from me, and then it became too late to ask John and Cameron to fill in. So, yes, I will be here Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday next week, and hopefully you will join us each one of those days. Now, coming up top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy. Also, a Stephen Miller joining us on the program from Fox News, writing about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York City. He says Democrats nationally now own their loony far-left flank. Tony Katz of WIBC going to join us next hour as well. Speaking of the far-left flank, I noted in the program earlier this week that there are actually going to be protests of the ICE facility in Farmville, Virginia this weekend, because there is an ICE facility in Farmville. And it's the weirdest thing, Cameron, because I was doing a little bit of research. The local newspaper, the Farmville Herald, wrote about this today. So this was built in 2010, which I believe we're now referring to as the prequel years of the Trump administration. We don't really talk about who was in office in 2010. It was just, you know, the prequel years.
It was the pre-crime era.
Exactly. For the past 8 years, there's been no protests, no nutty professors out at Longwood University, and I don't really think there are that many nutty professors at Longwood University. We haven't had any protests, nothing during the Obama administration. Now we've got a protest here in Farmville. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Sunday, when the high is supposed to be 96 degrees. God bless him. I thought about, Cameron, I figured this would be a little too ironic, though. I was thinking about actually bringing some ice water to the protesters on Sunday. But I didn't know if that would be appreciated or not.
Probably not.
Get my Orca cooler with my NRA sticker and just go down and hand out ice water, because it is going to be warm. We were supposed to have two protests. There was going to be one this Sunday. There was going to be one July the 7th. And I'm thinking now, the organizers got together and said, we probably don't have enough people willing to protest to have two protests. What if we just combined the protest into one protest? So that's what's taking place. The protest schedule for July the 7th here in Farmville has been kind of just consumed by the protest, which is supposed to take place on Sunday. So I may go down with some ice water for the protesters? I may not. I got invited to go kayaking on Sunday morning instead. So kayaking, you know, going to watch the protesters, it's a iffy proposition. So I don't know. It's Twitterless Sunday, though. So either way, you won't see any social media about it, one way or the other.
And we're supposed to, I keep seeing every once in a while I look at like things to do on through Facebook. They have a good event section, and it is chock full tomorrow of protests all over D.C. tomorrow, from the White House to the Capitol to the ICE building. But I wonder, and I'm thinking the heat might have a lot to do with the attendance, but I'm wondering if the Justice Kennedy situation has sucked so much oxygen out of the room that people are refocusing their efforts. But then I looked yesterday, there were a lot of people walking down Pennsylvania Avenue and protesting, but I don't know how many they were looking for. So it'll be interesting to see how many people show up and if the Kennedy thing is kind of sidelining it.
Yeah, it is interesting because there's the politics being played, and then there's the protests, and then the two are sort of meeting somewhere in the middle. And because again, a lot of these protests that you're seeing, they're not real grassroots protests, right? They're organized protests. They could be rallies, but they're taking the form of protests instead. So as you get closer to the midterms, and again, there have been some pieces in mainstream publications this week kind of fretting and worrying, is the left going too far? Are we going out on a limb? Is this going to backfire for us in the midterms? Largely what Ed Morrissey and I talked about last hour, about appealing, you know, look, politics, just pure politics, forget about ideology for a second, forget about principles for a second. Let's just talk politics. In politics, you win by adding, right? You win by addition. You win by bringing people in, because you've got to have more votes than the other party or the other candidates. And you don't do that, generally speaking, by running those sort of purity tests, by saying, well, unless you agree with us 100%, get out of the tent, right? It's about bringing people in. And that's really important in a midterm election year, when turnout typically drops below that of a presidential election year. Right now, the left, their turnout model is basically rile up our base and hope that not only are we riling up our base, but that we can use our base to tap into sort of the left's version of what President Trump did in 2016, tapping into people who don't normally vote. They don't show up for any election. In Selena and Brad's book, The Great Revolt, they have a chapter called the Peroistas, which are about those Trump voters who really the last time they voted for president in many cases was Ross Perot. Back in the, you know, you thought my California Raisins reference was dated. Ross Perot just sent the millennials looking, scurrying to Wikipedia, right? Who? Right. Exactly. So they haven't voted for president in a while, but they showed up in 2016 and they voted for Donald Trump. The left this year is hoping, rather than, again, you know, talking to those Trump voters in the Midwest or in the Rust Belt states, it's about getting those folks who haven't voted before angry enough to show up on election day to cast that anti-Trump vote. You know, one of the, and oddly enough, and we'll talk about this with Stephen Miller, one of the few candidates that I've seen this year that's actually running a positive message is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And we talked about that, you know, 2-minute ad for her that ran online, and it didn't mention President Trump once. It didn't mention Republicans once. Also didn't mention Democratic Socialists once either, which is a key point there. It was, for the vast majority of that ad, it was an ad that a Tea Party candidate could have run. It was an ad that, in many ways, Donald Trump could have run, because it was talking to working class residents of New York City, particularly, I think, in Queens, where the Congressional District New York 14 is located. And we're falling behind. Look at these skyscrapers that are being built. Look at how the city is changing right around your eyes. But is it changing for you? Are you going to be able to afford one of those apartments in that sky rise that's going up? Or are you worried about being able to stay where you are right now? things keep getting worse for the working class while the wealthy are living large here in New York. And you need somebody who's going to listen and represent you. Again, that's not a socialist message. That's a populist message. That's a message of I'm going to go and I'm going to represent you. I'm not like those fat cats. I'm not like those people who take the Wall Street dollars. I'm not like Joe Crowley. I'm not like an established politician. I'm new and I'm different. And then with about 15 seconds left in the ad, it was, and you should get a guaranteed job at a living wage. And you should get free college tuition. And you should be guaranteed housing. And we should have Medicare for all. And it would be interesting if we had truth in advertising laws, Cameron. I was thinking there would be a little cash register sound that would come up after every one of those, right? It was ching, 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 but we don't, and it didn't.
Well, there was a story the other day. I'm not sure the exact number. I think it was $113,000. If you earned $113,000, I mean, give or take a couple thousand, in San Francisco, mm-hmm. you were at or below the poverty line. I mean, it was barely surviving in San Francisco, and it's interesting to see how these liberal utopias. I mean, San Francisco, number one with a bullet, and then number two, probably New York. How that message will come across to people who have to rent bunk beds to be able to afford to live in their liberal utopia in the San Francisco or in Brooklyn. It has got to be a very weird dichotomy for them. They want to live in these places so bad, but at the end of the day, it's really hard to afford to live in these places.
Right, and that's, you know, again, this is where you have to get beyond the soundbite solutions and you have to start actually talking about things. And all right, well, how are we gonna make this work, right? How are you gonna do this? Now, first of all, look, I know there's not a part of the United States that I don't like. There are parts of the country that I haven't visited. There are parts of the country that I would choose not to live in. I would never live in New York, but I don't have anything against people who want to live in New York. Have at it. I mean, you know, I'd love to visit there for a couple of days at a time on occasion. It's been a while and I haven't really missed it, but whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you live where you want to live. But if you can also live well in other places, like if the only thing that's keeping you in New York is, well, it's New York. Okay. Then you're probably going to have to accept that you're going to pay roughly the same amount for a bunk bed in a micro apartment that you would pay for a three-bedroom house in Omaha. And that's the trade-off. If you don't want to live in Omaha, you don't have to live in Omaha, but it's going to be more expensive to live there in New York. It's going to be a lot more expensive to live in New York. Same as Silicon Valley. You know, there was a story probably about a month or so ago about some of the upper management in Silicon Valley, not the people who are sleeping in U-Haul trucks, but the people who can afford to actually live in Bend, Oregon, and fly to work in Silicon Valley a few days a week and then telecommute the rest of the time. Sounds like a great life, right? Not everybody, again, can afford to do that. But you know what we could afford to do? We could all afford a telecommute. I mean, if these companies, that's the thing that I don't understand. You know, and there was a day, probably, what would you say, Cameron, 10, 15 years ago, where telecommuting was the wave of the future, right? Oh, none of us were going to office. Yeah. We were all going to be working from home. Yeah.
That was the next,
and then something happened.
That was the next watch phone. Everyone was like, oh, telecommuting.
Yeah. And something happened within the corporate culture where I don't know if it was the management, you know, we don't have anybody to supervise. We don't have anybody to stand over with our coffee mugs and say, you're going to have that TPS report done by Saturday. They're not physically around us anymore. Or there was the concern about, well, if we're not able to monitor people's time, are they going to slack off? But telecommuting has kind of disappeared. And to me, that is one of the easiest things that we could do to make life more affordable for those who are just starting out. So you don't have to live in Silicon Valley. You don't have to live in New York City. You don't have to live in the D.C. area. You can actually live in more affordable places, even around there. You know, you drive out an hour and a half. You don't have to drive to Farmville, Virginia, to get out of the D.C. real estate bubble. You can drive down to Fredericksburg, Virginia. You go to Orange, Virginia. Beautiful, beautiful little towns like Gordonsville. We've talked about Gordonsville, where Cameron lived for a few years growing up. There are all these great little towns that are not exurbs of Washington, D.C. They're out even beyond the exurbs. But, you know, if you needed to get into the city for a meeting once a week or twice a week, you could do it. But apparently we're not going that route anymore. Now it's all about the micro apartments and socialism, and you'll like it. I don't know about you. I'd rather have a white picket fence in a small town for half the cost of a micro apartment in New York City. But that's just me. I just think that both of those options should be available. It shouldn't be you have to pick that micro apartment. You have to live in the U-Haul van there in the company parking lot in Silicon Valley. There should be some other choices available there. All right, we are quickly running out of time here in hour two. Again, coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to have our hero of the day. We're going to have our deal of the day. We're going to have our good guy as well. We'll leave you with this sad story from WLWT, Norwood, Ohio. It's been a while since we've talked about the ravages of the opioid epidemic in this country. It is still going on. As a matter of fact, they report on a Norwood, Ohio woman who police said was on heroin in a drive-thru with her daughter not long ago, arrested again, this time after overdosing at home, and this time her 13-year-old son was the one who had to step in and call 911. WLWT said the call was emotional. Yeah, I would imagine. If you're trying to stop your mom from dying, I imagine that would be an emotional call. Police said her son busted down a door to get to her, found her unresponsive. Called, said, my mom just overdosed. We need paramedics with her right now. 31-year-old Amber Fry, meanwhile, lying on the bathroom floor, not breathing. She was revived. 6 doses of Narcan is what it took to revive her. She's now in the Hamilton County Jail. And the kids are now in the hands of social services. Stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company. It's coming up next. We've got Terry Shepard, Larry Zanoff from Hollywood Weapons on the Outdoor Channel. So we got brand new episodes of Hollywood Weapons coming up here.
Yeah, we actually just wrapped the second season a couple days ago. Actually, I got here last night. So, yeah, and they premiere
February 24th.
February 24th, Outdoor Channel, yeah. 7:30, I believe. I think it's a Saturday. It's really funny. If you remember from last year, we really had fun with it. And God bless Outdoor Channel for trusting us, maybe. And really taking it in, I think, a fun way. We really, I mean, look, it's all, the guns are there, the safety's there, all of the stuff that Larry is great at is there, but I get to play even more dress up, which is critical to my happiness. It's true. What are you guys looking at? Don't you judge me. Don't judge me.
I'm judging.
Yeah, yeah, Larry judges.
Larry, you
judges.
Get to judge.
Larry
I'm
judges
judging.
All the time.
I'm sorry, you know. It's difficult to hand the gun off to anyone as it is, but to hand it off to him when he's wearing like 6-inch heels and tight leather pants, it really makes me wonder about my life choices.
I really wish that Tootsie had more, you know, shootouts.
Season 3.
Season 3. We do take viewer feedback. So the last episode, which he's referring to, they weren't 6-inch. They were 3. Mm-hmm. And they were those platform boots that Kate Beckinsale wears. I got to be Kate Beckinsale from Underworld and test, can you actually blow through a floor with bullets when werewolves are chasing you, which is a question I think most people have always wanted answered.
Yeah, I've wondered this myself. But
And so we aim to please on Outdoor Channel, and we're going to give you that answer. And I got to dress up like her, and Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, shows up. We just had a lot of fun.
I think what was really cool, too, is a lot of the viewers kept writing in after season one that they wanted something like from Quigley Down Under. So we listened, and one of the episodes indeed has him dressed up as Quigley Down Under. And
with the mustache.
With the mustache, yeah.
And that's pretty sure that's going to be the premiere
opening
episode.
Season,
the premiere is going to be that. And on that note, too, we've really, you know, it's Hollywood Weapons. Larry and I like to think we're cool, but no one really cares about he and I. But we got to interview Tom Selleck. He was a big part of the show.
That's big.
Yeah, because it's Hollywood Weapons. And Gary Sinise was gracious. Nick Searcy from Justified. Daniel Henney, the new guy from Criminal Minds, super nice guy. We've had a lot of good people come in, and I think that adds to it because you're talking to the guys, the actors who were in that scene or in that show, and that we just give it a go.
Well, it absolutely does add to it, but I will say, and don't let this go to your head, Terry, but, you know, there is good chemistry between you and Larry. That's a big part of the show.
We're friends.
It's fun to watch. You learn something.
Cool. Thank you.
But, you know, at the end of the day, when you're sitting down in front of a television set, it's entertainment, and you guys are very entertaining.
Oh, good. It's coming. I wasn't sure it was coming across.
we thought we're definitely entertaining ourselves.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, Larry and I, when we first met for this, God, it seems like a long time ago, we just knew he was riffing on me, I was riffing on him, and I think they didn't expect it quite that way, and they let us run with it. And look, you know, Larry knows his business, and, you know, we both have the same mind, too. I was a Special Forces guy, just retired about a year plus ago from being a team sergeant. So we in our own ways, we have to plan and conduct and supervise very safe training. In my case, it's training or operations. And for Larry, he's dealing with movies. Now, you know, you deal with guys who don't usually handle guns, yep. Right? So how am I different? Go ahead and compliment me.
I'm still judging. So I think the big difference and what's really, really cool about this show is that the Outdoor Channel gave us the opportunity to run in the direction that we wanted to go in.
Yeah.
It started out, we talked about this last year, the pilot is the most boring episode of season one, honest with you, because we really didn't find our groove or anything. But then afterwards, instead of just having the writer write the script for us, mm-hmm. they kind of let us run with it, and they followed the direction we were going.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Stephen Miller from FoxNews.com. He's got a piece of the New York Post with Ocasio-Cortez's rise. Democrats, he says, now own their loony far-left flank. Also, Tony Katz of WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, joining us on the program this hour. Let's get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, as well as our good guy here. Hero of the day from Santa Clarita, California, KHTS, a story out of Castaic, California. And this story actually goes back to 2017. But we're now, this is also sort of a combined hero slash deal of the day. So the headline is Home Invader Shot by Castaic Homeowner Reaches Plea Deal. Yeah, to be sentenced next year. A home invader shot by a homeowner in 2017 pleaded no contest to charges stemming from the botched burglary as part of a plea deal and will be sentenced next year. Johnny Velasquez, a resident of Northridge, California, pleaded no contest to vandalism, over $400 in damage, as well as a misdemeanor charge for trespassing by entry or occupying. In return for the no contest plea, prosecutors agreed to drop the original charge of first degree burglary with a person present. That would be a felony. So again, we've got felonies that are pled down to misdemeanors. And as a result, the consequences, there aren't that many. Velasquez pleaded guilty on May 23rd, 2018. He will receive his sentence May 23rd, 2019. And I guess in the meantime, he's out on bond awaiting his sentencing. He'll show up for his sentencing a year from now. And I'm guessing that one of the terms of his sentence and one of the terms of this plea agreement is if he keeps his nose out of trouble, if he doesn't get arrested, if he doesn't show up in the court filings or doesn't make newspaper headlines over the next year, when he goes back, all will be forgiven and the charges will be dropped or the sentence will be suspended. So, in all likelihood, unless Johnny Velasquez reoffends and is caught, this is the end of this story. It was back on June 26, 2017. Woman noticed Velasquez was trying to force entry into her home. And this was in a fairly rural area of Santa Clarita County, up in one of the canyons. He actually got inside, and the woman fled. She ran out of the house. She called 911 to report the break-in. And then after she made the call, she saw Velasquez leave her house. So she saw him go. So she went back inside. She barricaded the front door. She is again, the police are on their way, but she's now back inside her home. And then Velasquez came back and he broke into her home a second time, this time breaking through a back door. By this time, the woman had armed herself with a handgun. And after a confrontation with Velasquez, the homeowner fired, hitting Velasquez in the chest. Neighbors in the remote canyon, according to KHTS, said that they were not surprised that the homeowner got the upper hand, saying that sheriff's deputies' response times to their neighborhood were not as quick as other areas, and residents, quote, are prepared for anything that could happen in that time. Mm-hmm. In Santa Clarita County, California. Takes a while for police to get here. So we know that we have to be able to protect and defend ourselves. Velasquez released from the hospital July 13th, 2017. He was taken into custody by sheriff's deputies. And now, apparently, again, if he stays out of trouble and stays out of other people's homes for the next year, Mr. Velasquez probably won't be facing any more time behind bars. Meanwhile, the homeowner able to protect herself from Mr. Velasquez, she is today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day from Houston, Texas, Channel 2, KHOU. Four men with lengthy criminal histories arrested this week during a vehicle burglary in northeast Houston. Houston Police Department officers say they saw Jared Armstrong, Trevian Young, Tyrone King, and Bacardi Menefi using a large steel chain to break the window of a vehicle parked near the Crofton Place Apartments on Crofton Street. The known gang members were taken into custody, charged with unlawful possession of a criminal instrument as well as engaging in organized criminal activity, which will add, KHOU says, to the long rap sheets for the men. For example, at the time of his arrest, Tyrone King found to be out on bond for aggravated robbery as well as felon in possession of a firearm for a crime that was committed in October of last year. He was arrested after a police impersonation home invasion robbery. He was found in possession of a loaded firearm after running from police. He was able to post a $5,000 bond, that's it, on the firearm in the possession of a felon charge, a $30,000 bond on the aggravated robbery charge, and so he's been out on the streets ever since. Now, this is, again, this is we can talk about criminal justice reform. We can talk about the bond system, which right now, it helps to ensure that nonviolent offenders who have no gang connections, maybe you get arrested for shoplifting and you've got a $5,000 bond, but you don't have any criminal associates. You don't have any illicit money from drug deals. You're probably staying in jail until your trial date. Now, if you are a gang member, you're well connected, you've got money coming in through the black market sale of drugs and whatnot, you might be able to raise that $5,000. You might be able to raise that $30,000. You might even be able to raise $300,000. And so you get out, and you may very well commit another crime while you're out on bond, and you may very well be able to bond out even after that. Yeah. The system needs some work here. Mr. King has an extensive criminal history, according to KHOU, that includes charges of robbery with bodily injury, possession of marijuana, criminal trespass, another felon in possession of a firearm charge, false report to a police officer, aggravated robbery, displaying a fictitious license plate, assault of a family member, forgery, and theft. At the time of his arrest, police say that Trevian Young was actually wearing an ankle monitor because he's on parole for engaging in organized criminal activity. He was sentenced in 2016 to 3 years after being involved in an ATM smash-and-grab burglary where he used a stolen truck to drive into a gas station and then steal an ATM. Got a 3-year sentence 2 years ago. Guess where Mr. Young is? Oh, but it's okay because he's got an ankle bracelet on so we can keep track of where he is. Did the ankle monitor let you know he was breaking into the home? Uh-uh, it did not. Young, according to Channel 2 in Houston, has an extensive criminal history, including prior charges of possession of a prohibited weapon, criminal trespass, evading arrest, burglary of a habitation, possession of marijuana, felon in possession of a firearm, burglary of a building, and engaging in organized criminal activity. All right, so that's just 2 out of 4, right? With lengthy criminal histories. Oh, wait, there's more. This is like the Ronco of criminal justice, Cameron. But wait, there's more. Jared Armstrong down in Houston, Texas. At the time of his arrest, KHOU reports, Armstrong was found to be out on bond for felony theft from a 2017 incident in which he was charged after jumping over the AMC theater counter in Humble, Texas, and stealing not Jujubes, not Mike and Ike's, bank bags containing cash and receipts. Yeah, he posted a $15,000 bond. He, too, has a prior criminal history to include charges of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, reckless driving, evading arrest, felony possession of marijuana, and assault of a family member. So, okay, so it's all right. So three out of the four with lengthy criminal history. Well, but wait, there's more. We haven't gotten to Bacardi Menefi. And yes, his name is Bacardi. I wonder if his middle name is 151, Cameron. Would that count as three middle names? Bacardi Menefi found to have an extensive criminal history at the time of his arrest as well, including prior charges of criminal trespass, failure to attend school, possession of a controlled substance, unlawful carrying of a weapon, possession of marijuana, failure to identify a fugitive, possession of codeine, and displaying a fictitious plate. So Mr. Menefi, with the, let's say, the least extensive and the least violent criminal history of the four. There might be time for Bacardi Menefi to turn his life around here. But of the four individuals stopped and arrested during a vehicle burglary, three of the four have violent criminal histories. Three of the four are out on either bond or probation. And chances are, because again, this was a nonviolent crime, this was a vehicle burglary. Chances are, these individuals who are out on bond awaiting trial and are now accused of committing another crime while they're out on bond awaiting trial, odds are they're not going to be kept behind bars until their trial. They'll be able to bond out again. And they are today's deals of the day. All right, on to our good guy. I think it's the first time we've had like three deals, maybe a fourth, but at least three deals in one story, Cameron, in one car. And it's amazing.
And after Ronco, this is definitely the show that millennials don't understand.
I know, right? What are you talking about?
Old man talk.
I have to go home and spend some time with my kids this weekend just so I can, you know, get caught up on some references. I just feel like the living embodiment of that Steve Buscemi meme, right? Hello, fellow kids. All right, on to our good guy of the day, brought to you by our friends at Odor Crusher, Wilmington, North Carolina, WWAY. A woman is alive and in the hospital after a Wilmington police officer rescued her from nearly drowning in the Cape Fear River on Thursday morning. Officers responded to the river about 6:15 in the morning. Witnesses say that they saw the woman floating there. Officer Ben Galupi saw the woman struggling. He removed his gear, and he jumped in the water, swam out to her. He was able to reach the woman, was able to bring her to a nearby dock. Wilmington Fire Department, EMS, were there at the scene by that time. They were able to perform CPR and transported the woman to the New Hanover Regional Medical Center. Her condition is unknown, but she was alive when she left the scene there. And, you know, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We talk about that every day. But Officer Ben Galupi putting his own life on the line and jumping there into the waters to save a stranger. We thank Officer Ben Galupi in Wilmington, North Carolina, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, still to come, Stephen Miller joining us, his piece at the New York Post, all about the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. My prediction, the favorite for the next Speaker of the House, if Democrats take back the House in November this year. As Stephen writes, when Mayor Bill de Blasio picked Bernie Sanders to swear him in for a second term, it was a sign, much like a groundhog signaling six more weeks of winter, that the heart of the Democratic Party was changing, even if Bernie himself still refuses to acknowledge that he belongs to the Democrat Party. Stephen Miller says, Nancy Pelosi tried to wave away the obvious Tea Party parallels with the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by saying that the 14th Congressional District is simply a, quote, very progressive district They made a choice in one district. Let's not get yourself carried away. As Miller writes, it's becoming clearer and clearer that Democrats' days of flirting with the more radical wing of their party are over. They are now in a committed relationship with each other. The hammer entwined with the sickle. Party bigwigs, he writes, should have seen it coming in the 2016 presidential nomination race. Bernie Sanders was supposed to be Hillary Clinton's tomato can. Instead, he gave her a serious run for her money, such that the party had to lean on the scales in Hillary's favor just to make sure that she limped across the finish line. And Ocasio-Cortez, he writes, comrades everywhere have finally found their sleeker new model and can finally start to haul off the old jalopy off to the junkyard. Take a bow, Bernie-crats. You finally have someone to rally behind that doesn't have to be carbon dated. Ow. Man, that stings a little bit. But, you know, he's right. Because, again, go back to that ad. And if you haven't watched the ad for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, go on YouTube. Just look up her name. It's about 2 minutes long. Watch the ad. And don't watch it with the intent of, I'm going to roll my eyes, all the socialist things she says. No. Just watch it as a political ad. Watch it to see how effective it is. One of the knocks about Bernie Sanders was that he looked like Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future, right? I mean, they loved what Bernie Sanders was selling, but he sounded like your crazy uncle. And not just in terms of the policies that he was promoting, but in terms of how we would talk about these things. With Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she doesn't look like Doc Brown, right? She's not, you know, Reverend Jim from Taxi. She doesn't look like a crazy person, doesn't sound like a crazy person. You start listening closely, she sounds like a socialist. But she's not the angry old man yelling at clouds that Bernie Sanders was. And again, she's 28 years old. When she's talking about these economic issues, is she going to be able to relate? Are younger voters going to be automatically able to relate more to her, regardless of what it is that she's saying? But just because she's a 28-year-old woman. And if you're 24, are you going to be more likely to listen to the 28-year-old or the 68-year-old? Or in the case of Dianne Feinstein, the 88-year-old? Who's going to resonate with you more? Regardless of what it is that they say, are you going to be more open-minded? And look, again, clearly for the media, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a superstar. And she's right there in their backyard. This isn't some socialist. This isn't, you know, William Jennings Bryan running and from the Kansas cornfields, and you got to hike all the way out there to middle America to go find this a savvy young socialist. No. She's right there in New York City. She'd be in any TV studio you want, like 15 minutes. So, yes, she'll be a star. But the big question is, how does this play outside of New York City? I'm sure it'll play great in D.C. Sure to play great in San Francisco and L.A. and Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington, Chicago, Boston. What about Amarillo? What about Albuquerque or Fort Collins, Colorado, or Waukesha, Wisconsin, Grand Rapids, Michigan? How does the message play there? We'll talk about it again with Stephen Miller of Fox News. Coming up right after this, stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way.
So, first of all, we've been covering your story. First of all, I guess I should ask the question, is this whole ordeal over for you?
Well, when we're subject to the DOJ, it's never really going to be over. But for now, I think we're out of the woodwork, at least on a local level.
So what exactly happened at the Outdoorsman?
Basically, I showed up for work. I go to open the door, and a woman says, hi, I'm here, surprise audit. So I said, okay, come on in. Nice to meet you. Here's my files. Here's my register. Here's my books, everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting the vibe that, we're not here to make friends. So it was one thing turned into another.
I was actually getting ready to go out of town on a business meeting, and she texts me all frantic. We're getting audited by the DOJ, which is strange to us because the previous owner had never been audited in 20 years.
How long had you owned the store?
Not even a year.
Yeah, seven months. Yeah, so we're still kind of trying to get everything ironed out. And they came in and did an audit. So I think they're kind of cracking down. There's some other strange things that happened leading up to that audit where We had people come in the store with, you know, illegal weapons, and we made them leave, obviously. But, you know, I'm not sure if it was just a big crackdown that they were doing, like a sting operation, or what was going on exactly.
Okay, so they're doing the audit, and you have two rifles in this store that are, quote-unquote, California would consider them to be assault weapons, right? Yeah. But you weren't offering these rifles for sale.
No, so one of them, we were in the process. Well, what it's kind of a long, confusing story, but when we first opened up, we were issued a big lot of rifles to sell on this lady's behalf, including, you know, a bullet button rifle, which was one of the two rifles that was there that was issued by the local courts.
Okay.
And delivered to us by the sheriff's department. But what our understanding was, and I believe the same with the courts and the sheriff's department, was that because these bullet buttons were inside the registration deadline, we were able to, you know, modify them to be either featureless or fixed magazine and then offer them, you know, for sale.
Okay.
So we were doing that, and then the other one was somebody's rifle that we were getting ready to convert.
Okay, so one of them you're able to make California compliant. The other one you're convert, or actually both of them, right?
But yeah, we're actually not able to make any more rifles California compliant. That was one of the things we got in trouble for. So we're not even allowed to take in the rifle and help people become compliant because they consider all bullet buttons assault weapons effective beginning of 2017. So everyone who has a bullet button that's waiting for the registration deadline,
yeah,
they're technically in possession of an unregistered assault weapon, but the DOJ gives them a pass if it's registered to them. So if they loan it to their buddy, both them and their buddy are now breaking the law.
Holy cow. Okay, so I have to say, somebody who lives in a state that doesn't have any of these kinds of laws, I don't know how y'all do it, honestly.
Yeah,
it's a lesson in compliance. I mean, it's, you have to be up to date with the changing laws because they change all the time, and, you know, you have to clarify everything. And the funny part is that we were being completely transparent. These rifles were logged in the book. I had them in the system. It's not like the way that they portrayed it was awful.
Like we're selling machine guns out of the back door or something. You know, we're just trying to help people become compliant with the new laws, and you know, they're making us criminals for that is what it felt like.
Did you get arrested?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They searched. So what? This is how it all went down. One lady was there doing our audit. She makes a call, and then probably like 4 or 5 hours later, we had 8 DOJ agents show up in like the full body armor, searched the shop, went back, searched our house. Obviously, we didn't have anything illegal there. But, you know, our kids were there, so they were kind of upset about it. And then they took us to jail, so it was a pretty good spectacle. The kids were upset and crying, obviously. The neighbors were all coming outside, super embarrassing.
It was like shock. You know, at the time, you're just cooperating.
Right.
But then in the days to follow, it was one of those moments where it's like, I don't want to do this. I'm ready to walk away from this business, from this industry, you know, because our intent was just to have our mom and pop shop, not to have something like this happen.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Join us in just a little bit. Right now, from FoxNews.com, writing at the New York Post, Mr. Stephen Miller is with us. Red Steez on Twitter. Stephen, good Friday to you, sir.
How are you, Cam? Did you get your bedroom nice and painted, neat, and the baseboards all straightened out?
You know what? I need to send you some pictures. I've got I have two more things to hang on the wall. I have to make sure they're perfectly level before I send you a picture, but yes, the home office is almost complete. So you'll
good
see your OCD can rest easy here soon. I think that the
good
painting
to,
will meet your specifications. Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
And I should have introduced you as a comrade, Miller. I apologize, given that you're now living in the People's Republic of New York City. Has Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has she been named the head of the comm intern there in New York?
Yeah, she's making waves. She's on The View today, and she's on The Colbert Show, and the Democrat Socialists of America have found their star, finally. They finally have a face that doesn't have to be carbon dated. So they're riding high right now.
I quoted that line from your New York Post column, and it's a great line, but it's also really true because, you know, again, one of the things about Bernie Sanders, my dad, for example, Bernie Sanders was his number two choice. Actually, he was Bernie Sanders. My dad said, my dad's 92, lifelong Democrat, voted for Trump, but he said, I'd vote for Bernie Sanders, but there's no chance he's going to win. So I'll vote for Trump because he's a disruptor. There were a lot of people who were like that. There were a lot of people for whom Donald Trump was their second choice. Bernie Sanders was their first choice, or the other way around.
part of the problem for Bernie Sanders was he looked like Doc Brown, and he sounded like Doc Brown from Back to the Future. He sounded like a mad scientist.
Right. And, I mean, people like, I mean, there's a certain sect that like that. People claim they like his authenticity, which is people said they liked about Trump. And, you know, I still maintain that there was between the candidacies, there wasn't much difference between Bernie's candidacy and Trump's candidacy, except Trump's actually won. But he was an insurgency coming into the right, just as Bernie was kind of an insurgency coming into the left. And, you know, the DNC managed to fight him off with all of their power, with their sticks, and try to drag Hillary across the finish line. But you really are starting to see kind of there is a little bit of a change going on where, you know, Bernie is going to be a little bit too moderate for 2020 Democrats. As you're starting to see, obviously, Ocasio-Cortez wants to abolish ICE agency, and now you're seeing Gillibrand come out for that, despite her coming out very strongly for it in 2009. Mm-hmm. She's doing a lot of good work in Hillary Clinton's former Senate seat there. And then you also have now de Blasio, who my prediction was he'll be a 2020 candidate. He's now coming out for abolishing ICE. So Bernie Sanders did not want to do that. And so you're starting to see this field now kind of coalesce around things that are too far left for even Bernie Sanders. You kind of see the Democrats finally starting to rally around what I call their kind of their left flank, which they've always had this uncomfortable dance with. They've never really fully wanted to merge with Bernie's ideas, and Bernie has never really fully wanted to merge with the Democrats. He still claims he's an independent, which is ridiculous on its face. But now with Ocasio-Cortez running on Bernie's platform as a Democrat, they're starting to own this a little bit, and you can kind of see the panic a little bit in Schumer and Pelosi's eyes, because I think that they're fully aware of how this is something that it can energize, you know, urban cosmopolitans and hipsters like myself, but it can't how well it plays in kind of farm country, and that useless chunk of land between San Francisco and New York is yet to be decided. And those people are generally moderates, either swinging left or swinging right, but they're generally not people who are out there saying, yes, we need to abolish the United States southern border completely. So you start to see them kind of fight it off, but the problem is Ocasio-Cortez is going to be in this party for the next 50 years. She's going to win her seat. She's going to probably hold that seat for a very, very long time. And so you can kind of see where the direction is going, and I think Pelosi and Schumer see the writing on the wall there.
I think that you're right. And I know that, you know, Nancy Pelosi said, oh, this was one district. It's not a big deal. It's not like, you know, the Tea Party. But if you look at, you know, and across the country this year, we have seen far left candidates run, in some cases challenging incumbents from the left. And, you know, they've not all been successful. We've seen, you know, in the special elections, I mean, it was a guy like Connor Lamb who won in Pennsylvania, not with an ad saying he wanted to abolish ICE, but he actually had an ad where he was shooting an AR-15. And he said, we're not going to ban any of these guns. He ran as a Democrat. Now, that's the thing, is the Democrat Party a big enough tent that both of those points of views can coincide? Because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is out there saying we need to ban these guns. Connor Lamb says, no, we got to protect them. And here's the thing, I mean, in terms of the party, you're right. I'm banking on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her ideology and her philosophies winning out.
Right. And the problem that she's going to run into, and she's already run into it a couple of times, is she's going to be meeting with mostly a fawning media. Mm-hmm. Just falling all over themselves, because you do. She's very articulate. She's very good on camera. She's obviously attractive. So she brings all of these kind of qualities that a party enamored with celebrity wants to have. And she's not going to be questioned on her policies very much. She's not going to be asked, you know, how you want guaranteed income for every American. You want housing to be a right. Or just owning a house to be a right, not even just get, you know, housing of any kind. You want complete open borders. You want, you know, all of these programs that are the farthest left of your party, and that you haven't offered a solution on how to pay for them. And I think she got that question once and said, well, I have an economics degree. And the people asking that question simply just don't have economics degree, and they don't know how to look at this like I do. In which case, that's still not an answer. That's, you're just simply saying, oh, well, in case you have an economics degree, I won't ask you about it again. That's not going to fly when she gets into the U.S. House. She's going to get up and she's going to make these speeches, and she's going to get a lot of airtime.
She's only 28 years old, so you people panicking about her for president, you have about 6 years, 7 years. But I do think that that's probably in her future.
Listen, I said earlier, if the Democrats were to take back the House this year, and I don't know that they will, but if they were, you would see a push, Stephen, to name her speaker. I mean, her fans, I think the far left base, I mean, you know they're not going to support Nancy Pelosi. I'm not saying the push would come from anybody in Congress. But the far left base that you're talking about, they don't want to see any of the folks like Nancy, but they don't want to see Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House.
Right. I mean, I think that Nancy Pelosi is someone who has made a career off of being underestimated. She's a huge booster for Democrats. She's an enormous fundraiser for Democrats. She's kind of a stalwart. She's not someone who's going to kind of be pushed around. So again, Ocasio-Cortez has kind of the youth and the energy with her, but Nancy Pelosi's not going to just be pushed out of her party. That's not going to happen. And Pelosi has a lot more loyalists to her in this party than obviously Ocasio-Cortez has. Now, Ocasio-Cortez might have the energy and the voters, and that's something, but again, I don't see kind of this full on rebellion happen. You did see Ocasio-Cortez hesitate to, jump in nominating Pelosi for leadership if they should take back the House. And you saw Pelosi also kind of marginalize Ocasio-Cortez's victory by saying this was just one district. This was one district in one race, and this isn't some big wave happening in the country. And that was kind of Pelosi's way of kind of putting her in her place. And so you're going to see this kind of power struggle between, you know, somebody who's just been a Democrat institution there for years and years and years and years against somebody who has the energy coming up, you know, fast. And, you know, it's interesting for a side of the aisle that called the Tea Party just extremist and racist and sexist and all of these things back in 2010, you're seeing the exact same thing happen. You're seeing the left kind of emulate what the Tea Party did, which is they didn't go out, you know, when something didn't go their way, they didn't chase people out of restaurants. They didn't, you know, they didn't chase people out of movie theaters. They didn't protest. They didn't block traffic. They just simply went to the ballot box and voted, and they ended up flipping the House in the greatest election wave that we've seen since World War II.
Yep.
So I do think that there's that kind of wave might be possible. And I do think it's only a matter of time before, again, the Ocasio-Cortez party wing takes over. I do think her platform is what the voters want. The question becomes is how long can Pelosi and Schumer kind of keep them at bay, you know, whacking a stick at them, before it runs out. And I don't think it's going to be very long. And you're already starting to see that with the 2020 field trying to adopt her because they know that they need the younger voters heading into a presidential election year.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, getting back to the fact that, you know, there's a different tactic here. This isn't the same folks. Well, in some cases, the Venn diagram might cross, but it's not about yelling at people in restaurants. It's about effective activism. You know, you've seen the campaign ad for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right? The sort of introductory ad. Here's who she is. And Stephen, like, you know, literally for the first minute and a half, that could have been an ad from a Tea Party candidate. Talking about the working class, I'm going to represent you, and it's not fair. Look around you and look how New York City's changing, and have you benefited from these changes, or have the millionaires and the elites, have they been the ones benefiting from this? It's not until like the last 20 seconds of the ad that you hear you deserve a guaranteed job at a living wage, and you deserve guaranteed housing, and college should be free, and we should have Medicare for all. The policies were almost an afterthought. And the packaging of this, as you say, it is really effective because it's positive. This was not an ad that bashed Donald Trump. This was not an ad that even mentioned Republicans. It also didn't mention democratic socialism. But they're not going to make neon signs that say I'm a democratic socialist. That's something that they'll address and they'll have their handy dandy explanation of what socialism is all about. And really just means, you know, cheaper goods for everybody. We just care about each other a little bit more. But the actual policies, I don't think they really do want to talk about this. They want to talk about the free stuff, but they don't want to talk about how we pay for this. And that's, I think, where we get into, you know, the heartland and the great empty space between San Francisco and New York. That is where I think this is not going to play very well at all.
Yeah, I always love the argument that, especially when someone like Crowley gets ousted, he's the number four ranking member of the House. that Ocasio-Cortez is running on, you know, our system is broken. And he's been in that seat since 1998. So I always love these arguments that, you know, Democrat policies haven't been working for my community and I'm just the Democrat that can fix it, which is basically what she ran on. And so those arguments always kind of, you know, I'm kind of intrigued by how you get around that logic and how nobody, again, asks them questions like that. But you're right about how they're going to kind of try to, they don't want these policies out there, but you're already, again, you're starting to see them push that way. You have a party who somehow believes the country is ready to listen to them on Medicare for All and health care 4 years after Obamacare was implemented and, you know, 8 years after it basically wiped their party off the electoral map completely. And so they're still full steam ahead on health care. And again, they're going to kind of keep pushing these ideas that, okay, we need a southern open border, and, you know, we want a guaranteed living wage, and we need all of this stuff. And again, they're not going to be in a position where they're really going to get questioned by it. So she's going to kind of soar through. She's going to enjoy a healthy honeymoon in the media and on the left. And then, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. But again, she's in for some rough waters, I think, with Pelosi. It's not going to be smooth sailing right off the bat. I think Pelosi's going to try to put the young millennial who doesn't know better in her place a little bit. So we'll see. But she definitely has the ear of the voters right now. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all develops.
Indeed it will. Stephen, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Do you have a backup plan, by the way, if you're ever forced to leave New York City? Do you have a backup location?
I have a few if I need to. But
you don't have to
I
disclose them. I just want to know you have a plan.
The thing is when the Civil War starts and everyone keeps talking about, you're going to need people like me behind enemy lines. So, you know, I'm going to probably have to just dig in and you know, do some subterfuging from behind the enemy lines when the Civil War, everybody keeps telling me, is going to start.
from Stephen Miller to Samuel Culper. Start watching AMC's Turn, Stephen. Lots of valuable lessons there. All right, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Have a great weekend.
Great, Cam. It was great to be here.
Stephen Miller joins us again. Red Steez on Twitter. I think Stephen needs to come out with a line of shoes, Cameron. Call them Steezies. Like, you know, Kanye's got the Wheezies. You have the Steezies. Tell me conservatives would not buy a pair of Steezies. I wouldn't spend $400 for them. But, I might, you know, $75? Come in at an affordable price? What? You don't think so? Cameron's shaking me off.
No. It's a terrible idea.
Fine. What a fine. All right. We're going to take a timeout. When we come back, Tony Katz will join us on the program. He should not have a pair of shoes named after him. But you should have a donut named after him. You should be able to walk into any donut shop in Indianapolis by now and just say, give me a dozen cats. And they'll know exactly what it is you're talking about. Stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
So often people refuse to put action behind the work. You know, a lot of people in the movement, they just want to complain. What we're doing now is going to shed a light on what's happening on these universities. Not only are we reporting on this stuff, but we're taking it to court as well when they try to silence people. And so that's never been done before.
Yeah, there
we're
needs to be activism in action, not
that's
just
right. That's
not
right.
just sitting
we
around.
We got to go on the offense. I'm sick of conservatives being victims.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We got to make victims now.
Well, yeah. and certainly on college campuses, you know, you guys are outnumbered. We know this. And frankly, the conservatives that are there. And I'm talking more now about faculty than
right.
students. They, you know, a lot of times they don't want to stick their neck up.
Right.
They don't want to, you know, expose themselves. Thank God for those members of the faculty that are there as guides for conservative students. I mean,
right.
they make a huge difference because I got to guess, man, it is so tough to be a small government, liberty-minded individual on a college campus right now when the hive mind mentality is
destroy everything that you love.
Yeah,
right?
They literally destroy everything. When they don't agree with you, they use violence, they use a form of intimidation. You know, it's funny you talk about the professors because the last CPAC, I had just finished speaking. I get off stage and, you know, I'm taking pictures with supporters and this college professor wants to take a photo. I wanted to put it on my Facebook to show the world, okay, there are some conservative college
right,
professors.
Right.
She told me, no, you can't do that because I could lose my tenure if they found out that I was a conservative. True story. That's what we're dealing with. People are afraid that they're going to lose their jobs if they come out as a conservative.
Was that a public university?
Yes. Yes.
Publicly supported dollars.
Yes.
But you know what we're getting here, Cam, to your point in Lawrence, is we're getting a form of, we've got, you know, the what I call the libel terrorism. They go out and they libel you in the public sphere. Then you've got legal terrorism. They come after you. They shut you down. They call you things, whatever they need to do, and they use the courts when necessary on their side. I've said this to people before, and especially to those of you watching. If you give money to a college or university and you support them, whether you write a big check, a medium check, whatever check you write, the next time you have a check to write to that college or university and you have a problem with them, don't withhold your check. Write them a check for a dollar.
Right.
Tactics and strategy. We need a strategy and a consistent organization like yours leading this. But then we need to draw them to the table. You write somebody a check for a dollar instead of $10,000, you can bet they're going to call you and go, why the $1 check?
That's exactly right.
Now you've
right.
got a meeting. The follow-up to that, we don't want you to shut down free speech.
No.
We want it all out there.
Right.
And we want everybody this side, that side. But, you know, it's not like the old days when I was president of my college Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
We debated with the Democrats.
Right.
We did things together.
I think there's this misconception that a conservative college students are advocating for more conservative professors. That's not what we're advocating for. We're advocating for professors to level the playing field where students can actually learn. Remember, college students are learning themselves during this age range.
Right.
And it's up to the professors to foster an environment where they can learn the different political ideologies, different religions, history. And so they can decide, hey, do I want to go this direction? But that's not the case. They want these kids to have an ideology, and they're feeding them information and saying, be this way. And if you jerk against it, if you resist what they say, then they punish you. No, they're not directly saying, hey, I'm going to fail you. But they intimidate you, they pressure you, and they silence you.
Welcome back. Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. It is Friday. It is the last segment of the program, and that means traditionally it is time for Mr. Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. And you know what? We like tradition here on Cam and Company. So let's welcome to the program our friend Tony Katz. Tony, how are you, sir?
And no Fiddler on the Roof entrance?
Well, I mean, I could do
like
the dance.
Cameron Gray is saying, please. Do I have to remember that he's Jewish all the time? Wow. Predicted.
Wow.
And, I mean, how many more softballs are needed in this life? All I can picture is John Pop going, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. That's it.
Well, see, that's the thing. John Pop's not around today. John Pop is on assignment, so he's not there to sing the song. Yeah. How are you doing today?
I am all right, man. Things are well here. We're coming up on Independence Day. And always worth reminding people, it's Independence Day, not the 4th of July.
Thank you very much.
It's not a date on the calendar. It means something.
Amen to that. I have the same thing every year I say this, and I feel like I'm the grumpy old man lecturing, but you're right. We celebrate Independence Day on the 4th of July, but we should remember what this is all about. And you know, I suspect this is going to be a really interesting Independence Day next week, Tony. You know, we've got protests. Cameron was telling us a protest scheduled all across D.C. Over the weekend, protesting immigration and customs enforcement. And I imagine that they're going to continue on through next week. We may even see a day of massive protests in our nation's capital on Independence Day. I think each and every year we should stop to think about the freedoms that we actually possess here in this country as Americans that others don't. But this year, you know, it's going to be really, really important not only that we recognize those freedoms, but that we work to protect those freedoms because they are definitely under assault right now.
Well, they're all under assault. They're always under assault. Don't get me wrong, but you put people out on the street who want to protest how the government's handling something. Well, that's part of the whole point. I say go out there and do it. But if you destroy things, we're going to arrest you. I mean, that's the way it is. If you try and attack other people, you're going to get arrested, and don't be surprised when they protect and defend themselves. But protests, I'll do it. The First Amendment isn't just for me. So go to it and enjoy it. I think the real question, and the question that you're asking, a question that we've discussed, exactly what is it that people do value? What is the nation that people do want? Because it seems that while people talk about protests and the importance of protests, some of those people would actually rather that they were in charge and you had no rights whatsoever. While they're not in charge, they believe in the full right to protest. Protest is, you know, is patriotic. Mm-hmm. Now, but when they're in charge, you should sit in the corner and just be thankful we haven't done more to you. That's part of the problem. People see America differently than you and I and us do, and a lot of people do, even people who consider themselves non-political. That's the weird part, and I think this whole immigration conversation has brought a lot of that to the fore. I don't believe polling anymore for its actual data, which is to say no one poll will sway me in any direction. But a group of polls will at least give you an idea of maybe where the country thinks. And when you take a look at a group of polls, CBS, that Harris poll, that Harvard poll, some other ones, you start really get the feeling that the midterms are going to have no the immigration debate is going to have no play on the midterms. Because while people may not like President Trump, or they may not like the idea of separating families, in the end, they like the idea of having a strong border. So the immigration debate doesn't play as strongly in the midterms as, let's say, tax cuts or tariffs is going to play, because that messes with somebody's dollars and cents. I think that's pretty interesting. But protest away and stay hydrated. It's going to be hot this weekend.
It is indeed, yes. Mid-90s in our nation's capital, going to feel like 100. One of the other big stories this week, obviously the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy. And now
really?
Yeah, I know, right? Did you hear about that one, Tony? Did that one slip by you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for ruining the segue, jerk. Jiminy Christmas. Why do we have this guy on, Cameron? Just send him a dozen donuts and send him packing.
I think I'm part of the diversity contract.
Yeah, that's it. So Joe Biden apparently said today that what we need is a, quote, consensus candidate for the Supreme Court. I wish the president would engage in conversations and nominate a consensus candidate. That's what we've done in the past, he said. That's what America needs and deserves. He won't. Who was the consensus nominee to the Supreme Court during the Obama administration, Tony?
I don't know what the hell he's talking about, neither does he. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I would ask if Joe Biden was drunk when he said that. Sonia Sotomayor is a consensus nominee. Sonia Sotomayor won't even admit that the president has the power to decide policy. She'll decide that the power exists only whether or not she likes the president. What is he talking about indeed? I would have asked if Joe Biden was sober when he made that statement. I would play that statement for my kids and say, in this children's why you don't do meth. That's that kind of out of control crazy, like he's on a substance. But with Joe Biden, you know that that's not the case. You just know that he says things. He knows that they're not true, but this is the kind of thing that he says. Remember, he has that same Trumpism kind of thing. He just says things, you know. He's not worried so much about the truth. He's just worried about putting it out there.
It may very well be, and it's not like he has any more of a say than anybody else does. Meanwhile, you've got senators who are Democrat senators who are targeting Democrats, including Indiana's Joe Donnelly, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, all stepping up to the microphone to demand, quote, unwavering opposition to Trump's nominee, whoever that is. We don't even know who it is yet, but already you've got Democrats clamoring that the party must march in lockstep in opposition. Gillibrand shouting at the top of her lungs at the rally, according to the Washington Post. The battle lines have been drawn. Which side are you on? Joe Donnelly, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin, we know you stood with us in fighting back the repeal of health care. We need you to stand with us now, said Brian Fallon, the executive director of Demand Justice. So let me ask you, I mean, from an Indiana perspective, what do you think Joe Donnelly is going to do, Tony?
Joe Donnelly is going to spend this weekend crying under his bed and wishing none of this was happening. What Joe Donnelly is going to do? Joe Donnelly supported the nomination of Neil Gorsuch. Joe Donnelly
did that because it was the only political position that he could take, because he then utilized other times to, for example, oppose tax cuts. Joe Donnelly didn't vote for tax cuts. No Democrat did. But it's going to be very hard for Joe Donnelly to now say, well, Gorsuch was fine, but somebody else just like Gorsuch is not fine. And it's going to play as, he's just a political guy. Do it. We thought he was an independent. We thought he was this moderate Democrat. We thought he was a guy who wasn't beholden to any party, as he likes to talk about in his ad campaigns here, as he's driving his RV all around the state. But it turns out that Chuck Schumer does indeed hold the key to his gimp box. That's how it's going to go down. And he can't do anything about it, because if he votes with for the nominee, and we don't know who the nominee is yet. So right now it's
right.
Just a whole big forecasting, right? But if you make the assumption that a nominee is picked, let's use Mike Lee as the example. There is no argument that can be made that Mike Lee doesn't have judicial temperament. Right? You can't make that argument.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question that Mike Lee is not a divisive force in the Senate. He's not a Ted Cruz, let's say. Well, then what's the argument for voting against him? Or let's take a look at some of the rest of that list and take a look at a woman named Amy Coney Barrett, who's on the Seventh Circuit, who comes down to the University of Notre Dame, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about basically in Donnelly's backyard. What's going to be his argument? This is the same woman that Dianne Feinstein lambasted for saying that, you know, maybe you're too Catholic to do this. So what's going to be Donnelly's argument? That he's on the side of going after people on religion and religious litmus tests? That's going to be ugly, ugly stuff. When I say he's crying under his bed, it's not. I don't think I'm joking. I think I'm close to reality here. And if he votes against a nominee like those two that I just mentioned, well, then we know that Chuck Schumer is the one who wears the pants.
Talking again with our friend Tony Katz from WIBC. When do you think this becomes a campaign issue for Mike Braun, the Republican candidate for Senate in Indiana?
This should have been an issue today. And I will tell you, I've met Mike Braun. I've interviewed Mike Braun. I think Mike Braun can win. He certainly has the financial resources to win. What they did in that primary was an unbelievable job of campaigning and painting the other candidates who are both members of Congress. I have not seen enough of Mike Braun on the airwaves. I have not heard enough of him on radio. I have not seen enough statements from Mike Braun. I am flat out unhappy with it at this moment. Now, maybe they've decided they're going to wait until after July 4th because that's when things will pick up. Maybe they somehow think September and that's already too late. I believe that if we don't start seeing movement from the Braun team, as of the week after Independence Day, I think they've got a problem that they're not talking to me about. So I am very cautiously optimistic about the Braun people right now.
All right. Talking with a friend, Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. One last topic of conversation, Tony. We've got a couple of minutes here. Obviously, yesterday we were all watching about this time the news breaking out of Annapolis, Maryland, an individual going into the Capital Gazette newsroom with a pump-action shotgun, barricading the door, from what we understand from police today, trying to kill as many of those employees as possible. This guy had a long-standing a beef with the paper, going back to the paper's reporting on him stalking a woman back in 2011. He was ultimately able to plead guilty to a reduced charge of harassment. And you know, again, 7 years later, he walks into this newsroom trying to enact what I guess he thought was some sort of revenge here for how the newspaper had supposedly wronged him. We saw immediately before any facts were known, Tony, a lot of people started pointing fingers at President Trump. We've seen people blame Dana Loesch and her rhetoric for these actions today, while at the same time ignoring the specifics of this case. We also saw a story just a short time ago, as long as we're, you know, keeping an update on civility. 33-year-old California man has been arrested for threatening to murder the family of Ajit Pai, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission.
Oh.
Yes, for Pai's role in repealing regulations relating to net neutrality, which I'm guessing is not going to get a whole heck of a lot of attention here with this news coming out on a Friday afternoon. I'm just curious, Tony. It seems to me like we had a real opportunity, and we have a real opportunity to talk about some real issues. But again, unfortunately, what we are seeing are people trying to score cheap partisan political points off of a tragedy right now.
No, well, we need to be even more clear. They want to destroy their political opponents until they're dead, and they don't care what they lie about Dana. They don't care. They don't care what they lie about President Trump. They don't care. They want to destroy. As a matter of fact, they are told good work when they come out with a bigger and better lie. It's absolutely twisted. They didn't wait to find out any facts. They didn't. Shannon Watts didn't wait. None of them ever wait. It was uninteresting to them. It's boring to them. What matters to them is having the good one-liner, to having the good moment on Twitter, getting a couple hundred retweets, and trying to destroy their political enemies. That's what we saw. It's as clear as day. There is no political motivation to the shooting whatsoever. This is a guy who had a ridiculous grudge going back to a lawsuit, as you said. It was tossed out in July of 2012. It's almost 6 years ago now. And this is what he decided to do. That's 100% on him. We forget blame the shooter. It's how can we use this to political advantage? And it's only the sick and twisted, including, by the way, Chuck Todd and Andrea Mitchell. I'm sorry, Chuck Todd and Andrea Mitchell were on a different subject. Forgive me. I was just confusing the story with Anthony Kennedy because they were on my mind. So I apologize.
Sure.
I don't want to disparage people like that. I want to call it clearly for what they're doing. And you go through the Twitter feed of the people who said the things you said about Dana, specifically the president, are the ones I focused on today. And remember that it's always about destroying your political enemy. It is absolutely, positively not in any way about reality. Facts are meaningless when destruction is the name of the game.
Tony Katz, we got to leave it there, sir. Thank you so much for coming on the program. Stay cool this weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Play the fiddler.
Tony Katz with us here in Cam and Company. And see, sadly, it's been so long since I've seen Fiddler on the Roof. Literally, the only thing that I remember from the musical is tradition. And not even the song. I just remember that part of the song where they yell out, tradition. That's it. That's the only Tevye and Tevye. I know Tevye and I know tradition. That's it. I think we might have that on DVD. Oh, and I know that Zero Moss still played the starring role in Fiddler on the Roof. And that's it. Am I missing anything important, Cameron? I don't know. I can't remember the plot. There was something about a fiddler who was on a roof. I think it was next door to the cat that was on the hot tin roof. I'm not sure about that. I think Zero Mostel and Elizabeth Taylor were neighbors. I think that's the plot. Anyway, I'll watch it this weekend. Thanks so much for being a part of the program. Another reference millennials won't get. We'll end it there on this Friday edition of Cam and Company.